Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome, welcome to this Tuesday evening edition of Head On. I am Bob Kincaid. Glad to be here. Glad you could be here. And just generally glad. I'm a glad kind of guy. I think it's going to be an interesting evening. It always is, as long as you're participating. And I don't know whether to go funny or go serious. I mean, okay, I don't know whether to go attempt at funny or attempt at serious. So we will start with the obvious good news. Good for some, not so good for others. It's a sad day for Norm Coleman. Norm Coleman is finally, really, an ex-member of the United States Senate. The man who was catapulted to the United States Senate over the corpse of Paul Wellstone has finally had to exit that august body. He will be replaced by a man at least somewhat closer to the spirit of Wellstone, though no one can replace Paul Wellstone, in the form of Al Franken. Al Franken will make the 60th Democrat in the United States Senate. And I said some people were happier than others. Obviously, Norm Coleman is crushed. Al Franken is happy. But I suspect there's someone else out there that I don't know how happy he is. I'm speaking, of course, of Harry Reid. Harry, I don't know if he's happy or not. I'm sure he's made some happy noises. But I don't know if he's happy or not, because at least for appearance's sake, Harry is now officially fresh out of excuses. Sixty members of the United States Senate are now at least nominally Democrats. So Harry is going to have to find new excuses for why we can't have employee free choice. Harry's going to have to find an excuse for why we're not actively being represented in the Senate in terms of a public option in health care. Harry's going to have to come up with some new excuses. It's summer now, you know. We have passed the summer solstice. The sun is waxing stronger, hotter. Those long days of summer that I remember as a child when you never had to come in because it seemed like it was never getting dark. They're here. And on a frozen day in January in Washington, D.C., in the Russell Senate Office Building, Harry Reid said, at my questioning, we will have a card check bill. That's what he called it. We will have a card check bill by summer. It's summer. Harry. And we don't have a card check bill. It's summer, Harry. And American workers still do not enjoy the full freedom of association guaranteed to them in the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. It's summer, Harry! And your promise is on the line. Your word is on the line. Your reputation is on the line, Harry. Where, Harry, is the Employee Free Choice Act? Is it being kept hidden from public view because you can't control your own caucus? Is it being kept off the floor of the United States Senate because mugwumps like Ben Nelson of Nebraska think more of major corporations than he does of working people in America, and yet he still calls himself a Democrat? Is that the problem? Is Blanche Lincoln the problem, Harry? She is, of course, the personal senator to the Walmart Corporation. Is David Pryor the problem? He's also from Arkansas. Is Mary Landrieu the problem? Soon we will be saying Senator Franken. What are you going to do with that 60 Democrat majority? Supposedly, you're filibuster-proof now, Harry. How are we supposed to feel out here, we who knocked on doors and shook hands and talked in line at the grocery store and the post office and the gas station? To get you that majority, Harry, how are we supposed to feel when we don't see you doing what we made it possible for you to do? How are we supposed to feel, Harry? Clock's run out, Harry. You're out of excuses, Harry. You know, when I was thinking about Senator Franken, for some reason the phrase came to mind, this is where the rubber chicken hits the road. Meets the road. Harry Reid, a man out of excuses and a man who, if he does not do something fairly soon, and by soon I mean yesterday, Harry Reid will be the biggest failure as a majority leader that the Democratic Party has ever, ever known. You know, I think if you look, I found the screen cap at buzzflash.com. When Norm Coleman conceded, they put up on the website a photograph of Al Franken in his facade as Stuart Smalley. Really, they did. And I suppose that the rabid, dead-from-the-neck-up Repiglican party expects that Al Franken will just go into the Senate and it'll be one joke after another. I hope they continue to underestimate him in such fashion. I also hope that Al Franken finds the real liberal wing of the Democratic Party in the Senate. Because God knows the Senate has not been the same since Paul Wellstone was taken from it. This should be interesting. Any bets on what the new excuse will be from Harry Reid for why we do not get a deprofitized health care plan? For why we haven't yet gotten the Employee Free Choice Act? Anything. You know the number. Let me know. What is going to be Harry Reid's excuse for not pushing through this legislation now that he has 60 senators, 60 Democrats? What's the excuse going to be? You know, in a conversation with activists, President Obama said that he wants to get rid of don't ask, don't tell. And he said that the problem we have with don't ask, don't tell is, in his words, generational in nature. The meeting took place yesterday. The president hosted it. It was to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, when the LGBT community began to refuse marginalization. Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach, a fighter pilot with the Air Force who is gay, attended the meeting and was told by President Obama that don't ask, don't tell doesn't contribute to our national security. And on MSNBC last night, Lieutenant Colonel Fehrenbach repeated the president's words, saying, he said, but we have a generational issue, and so there's some convincing to do. That there is a generational gap, it seems, in some of the senior leadership. Well, what's your excuse, Harry Reid? What is your excuse for allowing bigotry and prejudice to continue inside the United States military against people based on nothing more than something that happened to them at birth? What is your excuse, Harry Reid? Who are these generational problems? And why can't you get them rounded up? It's a question worth asking. And it's a question we damned well deserve an answer to. Any time that bigotry and prejudice exists in this country, we always have the right to ask why it is allowed to persist. And this is going to take congressional action, and Harry Reid is going to have to be part of it, and he will have his 60 votes. And the question is why he cannot muster his caucus to act in unity. So I'm sure that Al Franken is celebrating right now. I'm not sure that Harry Reid is. The excuses have burned away like fog rising, or like fog underneath a rising summer sun. And the American people are beginning to want answers. I know I do. What will be the excuse for not fixing all the weak, boondoggly problems inside the climate change bill that just passed the House? Well, the Senate works in a different way. And I just don't think that we've got it. It's not the same in the Senate. No, it's not. And it is made manifestly more difficult, Harry, when leaders do not lead. So there's that. This being the news having broken fairly late in the afternoon, I don't know if Flush Flemball has had anything to say about the news about Al Franken. But I expect that man is going to have a hard, he's probably home right now in those 26,000 square feet that he shares with his maid and his cat. And I imagine dinner isn't going down too well. Because Al Franken was, for at least a brief period of time, a talk radio host. And he has now been catapulted to the most exclusive body in the world. A body that will not allow Rush Limbaugh entry. You think they might like, I don't know. You think that might be gnawing Flemball just a little bit? John Fox tosses in his 2 cents worth. He says, if a debate hits the Senate floor on the big ones coming, health care and EFCA, Franken has a chance to come into his own. If he uses his gift for gab and pointing out absurdity, he could shake things up some, and he could. I suspect early on he will try to be most serious. But there's no doubt that he is quick of wit and quick on his feet when it comes to talking. And if they let him stand and speak, remember, Harry Reid, not so good at pulling together his own coalition, but quite good at making sure people don't speak whom he doesn't want to speak. And Rush Limbaugh is green with envy. Rush Limbaugh is having liver and onions for dinner tonight in a caramelized balsamic glaze. The liver he's eating is his own. Because even with his billions, it has not yet bought him access to the Senate of the United States of America. Oh, I think he ought to run, don't you? I think he should. I think that Rush Limbaugh, I think the Ditto heads ought to mount a campaign, don't you? To draft Rush to run for Senate in the state of Florida against Charlie Crist and Jeb Bush. Because the right is going to have balance against a bon vivant and wit like Al Franken, aren't they? How's that liver tasting? How's that liver tasting, Rush? Keep gnawing. I don't think you're going to like it anymore. And it's going to make the bile rise in the back of your throat every time you hear a sound clip from Al Franken on the floor of the United States Senate. That cat is going to run when it sees you here pretty soon, Flush, because it's going to get tired of getting kicked every time you hear the words Senator and Franken put end to end. Come on, Rush. You know you want it. You know you want to run for Senate. You're the head of the Republican Party. This is your time, Rush. This is your time. This is your chance to shine, Flush. America's waiting. Someone has to balance against Al Franken. That someone, Flush, is you. Where is Rush Limbaugh's candidacy? The world is waiting. So, just an idea. Just an idea. Isn't this put up or shut up time for Flush Limbaugh? Well, I don't know if there's a shut up time for Flush Limbaugh. And he resists having to put up for all he's worth. But after all the carping and all the complaining, this is where the rubber chicken meets the road. And there will never be another opportunity like this for Flush Limbaugh. America waits, and right-wing America calls. Draft Rush for U.S. Senate from Florida. Oh, it would be magnificent. It would be. So that's a starting place for this evening. Our buddy Marty writes in and says, Harry Reid's excuse will be Dianne Feinstein. You guys are quick on your toes. Maura says, Harry Reid is the most useless piece of crap to hold the majority leader's seat. For someone that was a boxer in his younger days, he certainly no longer has a fighting spirit. We have to remember that Harry is only in power thanks to the votes of the other Democratic senators. The only excuse I can think of that Harry has is that the angel Moroni, remember that's moron with an I, is his senior advisor. Thanks, Maura. Cindy in the Great Northwest says, now that Al Franken has shown the way, why not John Stewart for president? You know, I'd like to see John Stewart in the Senate. I like the Senate. The Senate does not have to be the way it is. The Senate is the way it is right now, not because of the hallowed, hoary, H-O-A-R-Y, hoary traditions of that body, but because there is an absence of leadership in it. An absence of verve. An absence of guts. How many people do you know that you would... Because, see, I'm not impressed with a lot of our elected representatives. There are some who are very intelligent. There are some who are far from it. Being in politics is a DNA. It's a marker for some genetic chunk of our DNA for ambition, not brains. Lord knows you can learn that looking at the other side. Michelle Bachmann comes to mind. What a piece of work. Here's a woman so doggone dumb that she actually may be doing herself out of a job. Really, this is precious. You know, the census is coming around. And Michelle Bachmann does not like the census. This is the woman who said, well, CO2's got to be good for us. It's natural. And she's been out fear-mongering the 2010 census. And among other things, she said that she implied that Barack Obama could use census data to imprison people. Those 8 years when FEMA was building the camps with the barbed wire on it under the Bush administration, they were quiet. No big deal. Because back then, you know, it was Bush, and the only people winding up behind barbed wire, razor wire fences, the only people, those people. People who deserve to be there. You know, Mexicans. Brown folk. But all of a sudden, Michelle Bachmann's afraid that they're going to come for her. And she's been running her mouth. She's been running her mouth so much that Alex Jones declared on his show that Michelle Bachmann would be on the program next week to talk about the census. Now, apparently, Michelle Bachmann does have people working for her who want to keep their jobs, which means keeping her in office. And Dave Ziok, D-Z-I-O-K, no clue on Ziok, works for, is a spokesman for Bachmann. And he said, I can tell you unequivocally that she is not scheduled, nor ever was, to appear on Alex Jones' show. Yeah, even crazy Michelle Bachmann won't go on that program. Oh, hell no! But still, she may have literally done herself out of a job because, you know, remember back before a guy shot up the Holocaust Museum, back before a guy locked and loaded and shot three police officers in Pittsburgh, Poplawski was his name, Von Brunn was the shooter in D.C., before the assassination of Dr. Tiller in Kansas, Michelle Bachmann was on the air telling her right-wing fringe element followers in Minnesota to lock and load. They listen because they're authoritarians. They do what they're told. Well, the Minneapolis Star Tribune has uncovered an interesting little morsel of fact. And they have written, the 2010 census will likely determine whether Minnesota loses one of its 8 U.S. House seats. Population determines seat allocation. Political experts agree that a few thousand people, not filling out census forms may be all it takes for the state of Minnesota to lose a congressional advocate in the nation's capital. Wow, Michelle. Does that brain ever start working before your mouth does? Because the Minneapolis Star Tribune continues, if Minnesota were to lose a congressional seat, Bachmann's district appears to be a candidate for absorption. Resistance is futile. Bachmann has been careful to say that she's willing to tell the census how many people live in her household, the basic information that will determine whether Minnesota keeps a congressional seat, according to the paper says. But that's a message that's easily lost in her fear-mongering. Glenn Beck didn't help when he pantomimed flushing census documents down the toilet. And that's a fairly respectable dead tree newspaper in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Wow. That would... That would be poetic justice with a capital P now, wouldn't it? We can hope. We have good news from Minnesota today, and perhaps after the 2010 census we will have more good news as Michelle Bachmann packs up and heads back for her God-fearing, family-oriented, pro-life little home in her northern Minneapolis suburban district. We can hope. We can indeed hope. So there is an abundance of stuff to talk about this evening. And your calls are also always welcome. We'll take a little break, and we will come back. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your own nickel, 304-658-3333. Email rolls into Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is Activist Radio. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. Well, that was an interesting and unpleasant little noise. I have no idea what happened. I've got no computer right now, but we are hot to the air, so let's just go to the phones and find out what's going on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
I didn't know what was going on. I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't know if I could hang
it's been a very interesting last 4 to 5 days.
Oh, God. I don't even know where to start. And I know that people are also whatever about the Michael Jackson, but I got to say I was a bit stunned by that. I was like, okay, you know, what's going on?
You know, I just never had this vision of Michael Jackson being an 80-year-old guy.
Well, yeah, you know, it definitely has that Elvis, you know, feel about it. And I'm not really that surprised just because of the, you know, his whole existence. But it was just kind of sad to see how they feeding on the poor dude. It's like, how about saying goodbye and calling it a day?
Is there going to be anything left of Neverland Ranch after that public viewing?
It's so, God, I mean, all of it is just so, yuck. I don't know. It all left a bad taste in my mouth. But I was just sending you one of my favorite Jackson songs. You could play in one of your interludes.
Oh, cool. Wonderful.
I'll just send it now. Anyway, It was something I caught in particular, but I kind of spaced it out now, and I was just...
Happens to me all the time. We'll find it. But
oh, my God. Well, okay.
It's kind of like when you drop a contact on a carpet. You know, you just got to be patient.
Plus, the old age is, you know, catching up to me. Sure. But, listen, the one thing I wanted to say, you know, so what's the deal with the health care now? Are they... I heard that Nancy Pelosi's not even going to let the thing rest for a week so people can read it. Now, it's bad enough for us to only have a week, but the damn Congress itself won't even be able to read the bill, isn't it?
Well, you know, this is another one of those consistency moments, Sandra. We didn't like that very well when the Republican majority started passing 900-page bills without anybody getting a chance to read it. How can we have any consistency whatsoever? And tolerate that being done by our side if that's what they do.
Well, no, but I mean, I'm still reeling from that cap and create a new bubble bill they just passed, because that shit is like 1,200, 1,300 pages. And from what I can gather from it, that just sounds like another bubble waiting to be blown.
Yeah, oh, I saw in the last day or so, I think it was a link that News Ninja Gene sent to me. A spokesperson from Goldman Sachs basically, no, we'd never create a bubble. No, us. Aw. So that kind of tells me, yeah, that something's rotten.
No, every other country is reneging on their cap and trade legislation. Actually, a lot, you know, Australia, Spain is, you know, everyone's sort of realizing that method may not be very prudent. And why, of course, we're giving 85% away. Why do we always, it's just, the whole thing just, any bill that's 1,300 pages, you got problems. You got lobbyists, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And I mean,
I don't care what the bill.
Remember when the bank bailout happened a few months back, Sandra? It started out, three pages.
Yeah.
And it wound up, how many hundreds?
Right. No. That's when those Cretans get involved. I mean, I don't know. I can't say I'm really that aware or articulate about the whole global warming thing, you know? It's not really my expertise, but I sort of think I believe it, I guess. I don't know. Anytime I see sort of how it can be used to create wealth, concentrated wealth again, I'm sort of, you know, fish-eyeing it. Because if you want to reduce emissions, why is it that you have to create derivative bubbles again?
Well, see, it's the whole cap-and-trade thing is disturbing to me, Sandra.
Okay, because I just am sort of, I'm trying to think.
I remember when George Bush talked about this kind of stuff and said, and it'll work because we can trust the companies to police themselves.
Well, right, the whole voluntarily, yeah, the business and volunteer, that's getting a bad name these days. If it used to be true, it certainly isn't so now, or I certainly don't trust it. And now you're trading off who can pollute? So you're turning the ability to pollute into more of a commodity that can be sold as a good.
But see, that's the thing about pollution, isn't it? It's not good or bad based on who's doing it. You know, if an infant formula factory pollutes, that doesn't make the pollution better than if it was a coal-fired power plant. It's pollution.
No, but the opportunity cost is on us, though. See, that's the, at the end of the day, that's the impression I get. You know, our opportunity cost is allowing someone else to pollute and pay. But, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, well, see, I picked up a ball cap. Oh, wow, my shallow. I think Environmental Defense a few months back. Red cap, and on the front it says just, because this was cute, ball cap, get it? It says just cap it. In other words, screw the trading, cap the carbon emissions, and start dealing with the problems.
Right. I mean, because we're not talking, I mean, the whole commodification of it is just what's disturbing yet again. It's like, is there any way these MFers can come up with a solution to help the earth and mankind without the avarice? I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm so over it. It's like, Jesus, when is enough? You know what I mean?
I know, and I'm trying to think of what one of the great Kurt Vonnegut books, Sandra, has this little passage in it where a lawyer is talking and he said, I was taught long ago that anytime money is moving around, if you can just get into that stream and handle the money a little bit on the way or on its way somewhere else, you can become very, very wealthy. And this is that.
Right. No, but it's once again, the sort of capitalism is so predatory and it's cannibalistic because it's pollution. I'm sorry. I'm confused right there with using food to run cars. It falls into that realm of just absurdity for me.
And again, I get exactly what you're saying, and I'm kind of flummoxed myself because how in God's name is poisoning one area or another or the entire breathable air of the nation and the world, how is that a profit opportunity? Whose idea is that?
Right. I mean, no, but, you know, yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of, like I said, I'm just, because I don't know enough about it, so I don't want to just spout off. I'm just saying that if someone's losing out and it feels like, you know, our ability to breathe might be at risk.
Yeah, a little bit. And, you know, I was having a conniption about $10 billion worth of carbon capture and storage, corporate welfare. Well, that wasn't enough, apparently. That's been run up to 60. Now, take that $60 billion that is utterly, it's going to be absolutely wasted. I think last night I described it as $60 billion to find the Philosopher's Stone or the Universal Solvent. We're turning carbon, it's alchemy, turning carbon into gold. And you take that $60 billion, Sandra, what does that $60 billion do inside this, inside the debate about health care in America? Reckon that $60 billion could come in handy there?
Oh, please, you know, it is sort of mind-numbing, and, you know, I'm still reeling because I'm in California, and I'm looking at Obama, because I played this for, you know, a friend of mine who's one of those, oh, no, no matter what he does type of people, you know, he's black, how could you type of, anyway.
Yeah.
I showed the picture of him talking about California, like, oh, well, we're not too sure about it. I'm like, you know what, bitch? You dropped all them dollars on the banks, and you can't come up with some money for the state? You see what I'm saying? So I don't give a F who it is. I'm looking at Obama. I see old Hoover, because that's what Hoover did. He didn't help the states, and the rest is history. You see?
Yeah, I do see.
and that's
why Paul Krugman was saying what he was saying, and he is still saying it. Stimulus is a good idea, but it's got to go to the right places.
Well, I know, but the idea is they're humming and hawing about a possible one or two-time deal They would rather let the safety net be utterly destroyed by some Milton Friedman freak, which is Schwarzenegger, who's salivating at the idea that, yes, 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 let's destroy the state once and for all in the name of, you know, free market Chicago. It's horrible. I'm telling you, it's horrifying what's going on here, because the people who are going to suffer, you know who they are. The same people who always suffer. And we have Arnold Schwarzenegger up there saying, no, 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 I'm not going to sign any stop gaps, nothing. I want it to crash until you do what I ask, which is destroy the public sector. I don't mean to be dramatic, but, you know, I'm up in here, I'm looking at it thinking, you know what? This is some scary shit. And then I look at Obama, oh, no, we don't, you know, basically saying he don't want to bail out the states. And I'm thinking, what's the... $3 trillion to the financials. We're talking about $24 billion
yeah.
for California, and maybe $70 billion for all the other four other states that are, like, teetering, right?
Right.
I'm confused.
I mean, yeah, that's what...
Me.
I mean, once you start talking about the bailout money, what you're fooling with there is just walking around the pocket jingle.
No, but I don't want to hear no moral hazard. I don't want to hear none of the bullshit that they throw out to justify screwing over people. Because it ain't falling right now, because we've already seen you give 2-3 damn near all of our GDP to the financial sector up in here. And you're going to turn around and pretend that there's a bad precedent coming with bailing out states? Are you fucking kidding me? I'm sorry. I don't mean to go.
No. It's a disconnect for them, not for us.
Well, I'm just sort of just sitting here looking at, you know, friends on furlough. Teachers like, oh, I don't know if I have a job in the fall. Students, oh, where am I going to get the last $1,000 to pay this tuition so I can get my degree? On and on and on. And these people here, they don't even know what's coming down.
And won't even, yeah, they will. It'll hit them before they know it's coming.
No, it's already hitting. I mean, my little twins I look after, they had summer school. Now they don't. You understand what I'm saying? They had a swimming pool to go to. Now they don't. They could go to the bathroom at the park. Now they can't. Okay?
The bathroom?
Right. They locked them all up. So this is, I'm just giving you.
We had this phrase that Kate and I used a little bit a few months back. Mad Max world.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It's like, I'm just giving you a little taste of what has gone down already. And it's not even, Thursday is when he's going to start issuing IOUs. With gleefully, from the looks of his sorry ass, every time I see Schwarzenegger, I'm like, you know what?
Where'd
your belt buckle, you Nazi? Ugh.
It's IOUs?
Oh, yeah, this is some real shit. Yeah, they.
Like to state workers?
Oh, IOUs to students, you know, some health intake, you know, where the old people go to croak. Various intermediate vendors. Oh, I can go on and on. This is, you know, pretty serious. And the problem is, even if they come up with a stopgap.
So, we got a problem here, because I'm guessing those IOUs aren't legal tender.
Well,
downstream.
It's just, all of it is horrific, considering that California could do what Argentina did and say, you know what, Wall Street, F you. What are you going to do about it? Really? Because what the hell are they going to do about it? California could just stop and do like, you know, I'm saying the situation is so horrible because they're willing to sacrifice the most vulnerable. And these dumbasses who think they don't receive services from the state, i.e. the fake middle class, they don't care because it's not affecting them yet. But they will when them motherfuckers run up on them because they ain't got no food or nothing else to lose, right?
What was that line about pitchforks and torches?
Well, it's just like the sort of, we've been so bombarded with this everyone's an island mentality, people don't even know how to respond. They don't even know how to respond.
And, I'm sorry, you floored me with the locked up bathrooms. I guess I'm a simple man, I'm simple. You know, if I hear that, I don't know. If I hear that a school's closed or something, They locked up the bathrooms?
Yeah, you simple. I'm simple. I was like, come again? You know, I had to read that and hear and research that one a bit. But, yeah, that's what's going on. You know, they about to lay off all sorts of teachers.
Well, I've got a real good friend in Southern California who says she's probably gonna pack it up and head home.
Yeah,
Texas.
Because
Texas is, dig that. Texas is in better shape.
No, the thing is, you know, because I read that shock doctrine recently, and you know, it's so out there. I mean, it's well written and well sourced, but it's just unbelievable. But you know, it's like California. You know, crisis, then you ram through this sort of privatization, the whole nine yards. And I look at Schwarzenegger because I know he's a affectionate, you know, a sort of Milton Friedman follower. And it's just sort of a perfect storm that's happening here. And as California goes, right?
Yeah. It rolls downhill to us. You know, because how many times have we been told California alone is the third largest economy of the whatever in the world?
Well, it's dropped to 8 in the last couple of years, but I hear you. The thing is, though, it's, you know, I have to get beyond the sort of Obama-sire thing. And I hate to use that phrase because we know where it came from, but this is not cool if he's going to let whole states go under. I don't understand what's going on. You see what I mean? Then I remember, oh, yeah, he taught at the University of Chicago. Dare I connect the dot or two?
Milton Friedman, courtesy phone, in hell.
And his wife was a hospital exec, right? More dots?
Dot, dot, dot. Pretty anyway, soon it's going to be Morse code.
Oh, right. Well, we need to figure out the code from this vantage point. Hey, listen, one other thing, and I'll let you go. That they're going to get that fool 150 years?
Bernie Madoff?
Come on, man. I'm sorry. I have to go with Mike, who broke that down really well. These greedy-ass people, they knew what time was. Like, oh, why are we earning so much money? I better not say nothing. Then when the shit cracked open, what, they whining in court? They give them 150? Come on.
And well, the fun part, the defense attorneys asked for 12.
Well, that's fine. I'm thinking, whatever. You know, you knew what, when you was making all that money, getting them returns, you knew that wasn't normal.
Well, you know how I feel about W.C. Fields and his three holy rules. You can't cheat an honest man. Never give a sucker an even break, and don't smarten up a chump. All right, the concept of you can't cheat an honest man is probably it's Zen-like in its simplicity and its subterranean complexity.
And it's just fabulous because it's like you know you may want to blink for a minute, but you really can't argue with that. That's outstanding.
Oh, you know, when Bernie, when somebody calls somebody and says, hey, you know, I got my money with Bernie Madoff.
And it's getting 11-12%.
Yeah, it's real. He's doing 15%. Get in.
Right.
Now, an honest person looks up and says, nothing gets that money. Something stinks.
Right, but the problem is that these rich people who lost money, they got they had three homes, now they have two, them people. The court is going to throw this man in jail for 150 years?
Well, look, I mean, this goes back to what I've said about our judicial system, the three M's. It's our criminal judicial system is designed to punish the morons, rein in the meanness, and above all, protect the money. And that's the thing. Bernie Madoff is getting 150 years for offending the money.
Yeah, exactly. Not only that, but I'm laughing because his wife decided, oh, maybe she should back off. I'm like, you know what, bitch? You're going to be floating in the water if you don't shut up.
Yeah, and, you know, don't issue the press releases talking about how you're going to have to sell the mansion, the home in Palm Beach and the fur.
Well, that's bubble town, though, you know. I mean, I figured, yeah, these people are in bubbles. Who, you know, that was unbelievable. But, you know, all them people, though. But see, I can't get upset. Like the basic idea is that they were just greedy. And that's what happens sometimes to greedy people. Couldn't have happened to a better lot, as far as I'm concerned.
The greedy people suck.
Anyway,
but yeah. I'm mean that way.
No. Anyway, yeah. So it's just, I don't know. The California thing, yeah. Of course, that's on my mind because I live here. But it's just more sort of stunning just to, when I just tell you just the little things that are happening. That, you know, the real tangible sort of pain, and people are just sort of pretending what, you know.
Yeah. The condemned ate heartily. And the band played Waltzing Matilda on the on the deck of the Titanic.
And the thing is, though, it's interesting because it's so bad that this one group is starting to speak up, which is medium and small business, because guess what? This fool is trying his best to privatize part of the unemployment insurance, workman comp, state-funded entity, which is fairly successful and run quite well. He wants to try to privatize that by selling parts of it for the budget crisis.
Oh, God.
And the businesses are freaking out.
Well, that's a fire sale, isn't it? That's a confession.
Well, that's what I'm saying. But you know what that means? It means that they would pay outrageous premiums. So they're all freaking out now. It's like, good morning, MFers. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry, you just do that to me.
Yeah.
It's that line I used from the in-laws where Peter Fox says, I don't know what's going to happen when a six-pack of Budweiser costs $1,200. It'll be atonal music.
Exactly, and it's just sort of like, what do you think is going on here? You know, if you keep the neck on one segment, that's okay. You don't think it's going to mission creep? You know what I mean?
Mission creep, God.
You know, I mean, they're out to, it's just, you know, there's the plan seems to be pay as you go and go, see?
Right, with not so much emphasis on the pay part.
No, if you can't pay, you need to go. That's what that means.
Yeah, Jesus. Well, you know, at this point, you're a correspondent on the front lines of the apocalypse, Sandra.
I don't even know why I'm laughing. It's more sort of, if I wasn't laughing, I'd be, you know, crying because it's so over the top. Because every time I look at the L.A. Times or the Sacramento Bee, which is right in the thick of it, you know, I read the comments, and the people are like, oh, good, hopefully they'll break the unions. Every other comment, break the unions. State workers make too much. You know, that's the only song and dance they have. And I'm thinking, oh,
well, no, seriously,
my
what's
God.
There are all kinds of ripple effects involved with this, Sandra. When Arnold starts issuing his IOUs and people can't make their rent payments or, God forbid, their mortgage payments, don't we get a re-implosion? You know, most lenders are tolerant up to about 90 days.
Oh, no. And not only that, but this whole joke that they're putting out about, oh, Americans are saving more. They're not saving. They're just paying debt because they don't have no other choice. Oh, my God. You know what I mean? There's no saving. If they're not spending, and they say they're saving, but what they're really doing is paying off debt, you know.
Yeah, suddenly we're Japan, and we're saving 15% of our income. No.
No, you're not saving anything. You're paying off debt because you don't have a choice. Because they're going to take your house, they're going to wreck your credit rating. I mean, you know, you really have to pay attention. I didn't realize the corporate media was as bad as it is until I was looking at it for a minute for the Michael Jackson trauma. Man, it's whack.
Oh, I saw an editorial cartoon the other day, and this always works well on radio, talking about visuals. But I saw an editorial cartoon that showed Mahmoud Ahmadinejad with an iron fist around a protester, you know, all spiky and sharp and scary. And there's just this little stand with a sign on it that says, media gone to cover Jackson funeral.
There was an article about saying, oh, Michael Jackson's death may have just killed whatever green, red, velvet, whatever kind of hell revolution they're doing over there. You know, and I had to laugh. It's so sardonic. What's even more strange is, though, with all this hell going on, we still had time to overthrow Honduras. Can you imagine?
We do get around. You know, I still want to know where John Negroponte and Elliot Abrams are.
No, that MF, listen, that you're right. Of course, he popped in my mind, too. Because remember years ago when it was like whatever in Iraq, and all of a sudden it's just bloodletting? Then you come to find out that fool is there? I swear, it was over the top. He pops up, and then there's death all around.
And you know, it doesn't even feel like conspiracy theory anymore.
Oh, no, it just seems like it's just open season. I mean, this fool, I thought he was going to, what, get reelected? No. Did they snatch him?
Well, it's... Is
he back? Isn't he still even trying to go back?
I don't know.
Well, if I see Obama working overtime to try to distance us from that mess, no, brother, you can't do it.
Got it, yeah. Got to take ownership sometimes. It's ugly, but...
That's not going to work because... No, it's Honduras. I'm sorry. It's too thick there. Too deep.
I haven't seen an update, but the Argentine president is going to go back with the deposed president. This is not gonna end well.
Wait, what's happening?
Yeah, the Argentinian president says he's going to take the president back, and that they're going to try to restore him to office.
Right, right. Well, you know what? I have no idea, but that sounds like a disaster in the making.
My favorite quote out of this whole thing came. I saw it at Bart Cop, and it came from a cab driver. Talking to Willie Brown, and he said, Michael Jackson managed to knock both that two-time in South Carolina governor and that two-time in Bible-thumping senator from Nevada off the front page. Republicans haven't gotten that much help from a black man since Sammy Davis Jr. hugged Richard Nixon.
Shut up. That's covering a long span, though, you know.
I think there's truth in it. My God, seriously. Michael Jackson dropped dead and may well have killed any hopes for any sort of freedom in Iran with it. Oh, my God.
No, it's so over the top. But the thing about it is he'll be the last one because I can't think of anybody else if they kicked it.
And for God's sakes, don't anybody tell Alex Jones. But, you know, the argument's out there that the CIA bumped off Jacko so that they could quietly go and crank up a coup in Honduras.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no. They're going to use Michael Jackson dropping dead to bump up a lot. I mean, with that Alex Jones crowd. But that Michelle Bachmann, she ain't going on the show? Why not? Ron Paul's on that show.
You know, I guess there's some things even Michelle Bachmann won't do.
Oh, she needs... When is she... Oh, she... They're all up on 2010, huh?
Yeah.
She'll probably lose, huh? What do you think?
She came close last time, but she hung in there because, you know, that suburban little neighborhood that she represents is fine, but she can be as crazy as she wants to be as long as she protects the money and votes the right way on, you know, on the stuff that really matters.
And, I mean, am I the only one, but this comedian is finally going to take the Senate seat? Is this some sort of bad joke? See, I forgot who it was that's winning. Freaking Al Franken?
Yep.
It's a joke. I'm sorry. I'm like, whatever. You know,
forget about it, Jake. It's Minnesota. I mean, this is a state that gave us Governor, you know, Governor Ventura.
Yeah, no, I understand. And please, don't get me wrong. I'm glad. I'm surprised he conceded, but... Then I think, well, it's that warmonger Franken, you know. Remember, he was all supporting the right.
Well, how long did it take? I mean, there were some knocks on Franken when he was on the air. One of them was the war, and the other one was the voting irregularities.
Oh, no, but that was like some sort of cosmic jubilee on his part, dumbass. It's like, how you feel about voting integrity now?
All about it.
You know, oh, really? All about it now, huh?
Oh, it, well, yeah. No. Because his ox got gored.
I guess. But, I mean, he ain't going to do nothing but go in there and roll with the rest of them toadies. I don't have big hopes, you know.
We have been made jaded, Sandra. We have
yes,
been.
Yes. Well, okay. You know what? I'll let you go.
All right. I got some MJ to crank up.
Okay. Bye.
All right. Take it easy, Sandra. Bye now. Email rolling in. Subject line, good morning, MFers. Cindy says, and you wonder why she's my favorite caller. I look forward to her. She should have a show. Oh, God, and if we ever get to the point where we can pay people, you know? God, hey, you got to have dreams, don't you? And, of course, June is ending, and we'll survive another month. And July is starting. And, yeah, I really am working on some stuff, but it's long-term, and it's going to take a little bit of luck. We are, a little more than a month away from Netroots Nation. I'm hoping the head man of Netroots Nation will be joining us on the show sometime in the near future just to talk about all the stuff that's laid out for this convocation in Pittsburgh. And we're going to do it. We're going to make this happen. And I think it's going to be exciting for those who can't make it there to be able to be there electronically and to be there with a substantially reduced carbon footprint. You know, it still matters, this carbon business. No matter how much of a market or a profit motive or a profit opportunity we're going to make out of it, the CO2 that we continue to pump into our little spaceship here is... very, very serious. So, jump in. The conversation is fine. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Oh, here's that clip from, this is that clip I was telling Sandra about from the in-laws.
Jesus. I don't know what people are going to do when a six-pack of Budweiser costs $1,200.
Oh, that'll be off?
You've got a collapse of confidence in the currency. People are going to panic.
Yeah.
There's going to be gold riots, atonal music, right. Political chaos, right. Mass suicide, right?
Yeah.
It's Germany before Hitler. Uh-huh. You can see that.
Yeah. So this is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. We'll be back. Brad and Desi on the way with the Green News Report as well.
Thank you.
It's Thursday, June 30th, 2009.
I want to thank every member of Congress who put politics aside to support this bill on Friday.
Obama takes a victory lap after a successful passage of climate change legislation in the House last week, but will it be short-lived? I'm Brad Friedman. Desi Doyen is off today on some important family business, so it's just me. Get used to it. This is a special climate change legislation edition of your Green News Report. Republican Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann hailed it as the end of the world as we know it.
The underlying bill represents the tyranny and the intervention of the federal government. What will we choose today? Will we choose liberty or will we choose tyranny?
Republican Minority Leader John Boehner said it was a, quote, pile of something we can't say on the radio. Very nice, Congressman. But even the progressive Democrat Dennis Kucinich of Ohio voted against it, saying that the bill, quote, sets targets that are too weak and gives new life to one of the primary sources of the problem that should be on its way out, coal, by giving it record subsidies. Nonetheless, last Friday, in a squeaker of a legislative victory for the Obama administration, sweeping climate and energy legislation narrowly passed the lower house of Congress by a vote of 219 to 212 after months of tense negotiation and last-minute deals, culminating in a heated debate late last week on the floor of the House of Representatives. The American Clean Energy and Security Act, also known as the Waxman-Markey Bill, passed by a thin margin of just 7 votes. 8 Republicans crossed the aisle to vote in favor of the measure, and 44 Democrats, mostly from coal and farm states, bucked their leadership and voted against it. The landmark legislation is the first comprehensive attempt to curb the nation's industrial pollution and the greenhouse gas emissions that are blamed for global warming through the implementation of a new carbon cap and trade system, along with funding and incentives for clean energy sources, improved energy efficiency, and a new green, or at least greener, infrastructure. The House bill calls for the government to implement a cap-and-trade system, capping the nation's emissions from industrial sources and issuing carbon allowances that can be sold and traded among polluters. Some environmental groups and even a few Democratic lawmakers oppose the bill in its final form for being too weak. They hope it will be strengthened in the Senate, though given the current makeup of that body, strengthening it seems unlikely at this hour. Sorry, guys. Most environmental groups, however, supported the bill, citing the urgent need to establish a starting framework for transitioning the nation to a clean energy economy. Lobbying from energy and pollution-intensive industries affected by the legislation reached a fevered pitch over the last few months, with millions of dollars spent fighting reform since January alone. Last week's floor fight heard critics argue the legislation would be too costly during the nation's deepest recession in 70 years, and that any action would be useless without commitments from developing nations like China and India. Republicans blasted it as too expensive and unnecessary. Here's House Minority Whip Eric Cantor on the floor last week.
The legislation before us will force America's middle-class families to pay as much as $3,100 in higher prices every year.
But that number, as the Green News Report has been pointing out for weeks, is based on distorted calculations from an MIT study. The lead researcher of that study has repeatedly and publicly asked Republican lawmakers to stop distorting his findings, but they didn't. Surprised? On the contrary, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office released a study last week calculating that the legislation would cost an average of $175 per year across all households by 2020, far less than the $3,100 Republicans insisted on citing. Republicans also argued that the legislation would result in American jobs moving overseas. Here's Eric Cantor again.
Can we be so naive to assume our businesses, jobs, and emissions won't emigrate to China and India?
Suddenly, Republicans were concerned about companies moving jobs and operations overseas. Go figure. Nice change of pace for you, boys. But Democratic lawmakers countered that developing nations would make no changes without leadership first from the U.S., In an impassioned speech, House Majority Whip Steny Hoyer argued the cost of allowing foreign potentates to add their own taxes to Americans at any whim was already far too high, and the Waxman-Markey bill represents an overdue historic step in the right direction.
Some would like to do more. Some would like to do less. But we have reached a compromise. That is the legislative process, and it is a compromise that can pass this House and pass that Senate, be signed by the President, and become law. And make progress. progress will be far less expensive than failure.
The legislation now goes to the U.S. Senate, where Democrats are working on their own version and have already made controversial concessions to the oil and gas industry. Senate Republicans have already vowed to block the bill. The president has asked Democrats in Congress to have a final bill ready for him to sign before December, when the world's nations will be meeting to finalize a new global climate treaty. Good luck to us all. Finally, a quick correction. In referring to the League of Conservation Voters in a report last week, we described them as a conservative group. In fact, the League is a conservation group dedicated to the protection of the environment. We regret the error. I blame Desi. For more on the passage of last week's bill and much more we didn't have time for today, as always, check out our website, greennews.bradblog.com. For Desi Doyen, I'm Brad Friedman, and this has been your special edition Green News Report.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
It's working again. It's working again. And I ain't complaining. But pardon a little bit of dead air there. It's fixing, Not sure exactly how serious he was, but just had another email from our buddy Marty. He says, if you can get space for Sandra on the air, I'll take time to go set her up. Wow, that's an offer. I guess, you know, Sandra's kind of got the say-so in that, though, doesn't she? But at any rate, we will try our hand at the next 40 minutes of hour number two of the program, and we'll kick that all off by going to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, here we go again.
Hey, Reverbo.
Hey, Bob. You happened to mention Vonnegut, and so that just right away my ears perked up, and I...
That was channeling you.
Yeah, I ran...
Conjuring you.
The resources. Well, you know, being a man of the possum, I am conjurable.
You are indeed.
But, before I did find a couple of great passages, as usual. You know, this guy's writing, once again, here we are back with God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater.
Is it from God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater?
Not the particular one you're talking about, but it could be, because that's what I'll paraphrase some of this, and you'll see it easily. Could be, as one of the rich characters in the book is talking to his attorney, who works for the same law firm as who represents the Rosewaters, who are like these billionaires. In case people in the listening audience are not aware of this book, it's about this incredibly, just unbelievably rich guy who also happens to be a bit idealistic. You can't even go into it. I recommend going to your library at your earliest opportunity and just getting everything by Mr. Bob. And I'm sure you would concur with that.
Absolutely.
It's nice that, so what's her name? Bachman? Congresswoman Bachman?
Yes.
She wants us to choose between liberty and tyranny. And Mr. Boehner, evidently he swore on the House floor. He called the bill up. Not to call it a pile of shit. Is that what you
said? Yes.
Boy, those two are brave, articulate public servants, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, they open their mouths and pearls fall out. Of course, you know, John Boehner was probably a little bit less than at the top of his game because he's all a titter, if you will, because he's going to get to go play golf with Tiger Woods. That was one of the big news stories on the for-profit media earlier today.
Hey, I'm telling you, I think we better just make sure of the whereabouts of Governor Mark the day that Jacko croaked. I'm serious. You know, I mean, anything to take the heat off. They know how to do this. I mean, we had quite a week, a tough week in the pop culture world. We had Farrah Fawcett. We had Ed McMahon. We had Jacko. We had Governor Mark Sanford. If anybody's in the pop culture world, he is now. And, of course, we had the lead singer of The Seeds, Mr. Sky Saxon.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is an epic week, tragic week for pop culture. And yeah, everybody, and in the meantime, yeah, we had a revolution, some kind of a coup in Honduras. We had a epic moment in Iraq, evidently. I didn't hear too much about that, though. And,
we have limited for-profit media resources, Reverbo.
Yeah.
As a consequence of that, we have to, it is media triage. Where the most deserving stories get the most reporting. And, you know, fundamental sea change in the politics and the outlook of Iran. Sorry, that pales compared to the death of a pop star.
Well, people have given up reading, as we know. People are totally into this. All they want is images, and they want them going by their eyes as fast as they can. But only for 7 seconds, because even more than that they can't handle. That's too much, too many images. God knows we're not going to be reading anything. So, yeah, we are, I guess, just putty in their hands at this point. It's like, here, just come take us.
You know, but there is a symbiosis. Do you remember when Ayatollah Khomeini passed away, and they had such a grief riot? That they dropped his corpse and rolled it around in the dirt and, you know, just really messed him up. And so, remember that?
Yeah, I'm beginning to remember that.
Well, they're going to have a public viewing of Michael Jackson at the Neverland Ranch. This will not end well.
Wow, there's going to be some speaking in tongues and some actual flying or something crazy.
Yeah, wish I knew.
It couldn't have been old man. What's his father's name? Joe? Yeah, his dad's name's Joe.
Yeah.
God, I wonder if it was his idea. See, I can't. You.
But I mean, people will be pulling up the turf.
Oh yeah, people. You're right.
Trying to get a lock of hair. Ew.
Oh, this is bad imagery there. Yeah. I got the nose.
You know, I just resisted the urge to say something like that, but that's okay.
Oh, you didn't.
Yes, I did. Right before you said it. I said lock of hair, and then I self-edited, and you did it anyway.
Well, yeah, you have that effect on your listening audience. Well, I mean, and then of course the thing's going to end up on eBay, I guess. After they're done worshiping.
You know, I've got little grandbabies, and we started playing I've Got Your Nose.
Well, you know.
What a horror that was. I've got your nose. Oh, my God, he really does.
he has the nose job because the man had like four nose jobs, I believe. You know the man, you know, he actually purchased a chimpanzee named Bubbles.
Yes.
Who like cleaned, I think it was a cleaning chimp around the house or something like this. And then he also claimed that he purchased the bones of the elephant man. You know about that?
I remember that.
Although some of this stuff kind of turned out to be not true. Because he, and then, of course, it doesn't matter what's true anymore with him. That guy actually took, he had three kids. I wikied him right away because I just, once I got to the Bubbles, I love chimpanzees dressed in human clothes and smoking cigars. I can't get enough of that kind of stuff.
Well, I'm old school. I still prefer the velvet paintings of the dogs playing poker.
Same deal. Same exact thing. Just, yeah. And then the chimp who tore that woman's face off about 6 months ago, almost.
What was the Ernie Kovacs routine?
I got over it.
That involved Ernie Kovacs and a couple of other people in gorilla suits.
God, I don't know.
Oh, then it was just an up-tempo little ditty by, I think, a French composer. No dialogue, just strictly visual. Oh, damn, I can't remember, because it was classic for its day. It was groundbreaking.
Yeah, he verged on the surreal, that guy.
Oh, yeah.
He was before me somewhat. Him and Sid Caesar and some of these guys, I read about them now, and I'm just stunned at some of this early TV stuff. But what do you think, what was it like he was conducting, these guys who were in grill suits pretending to conduct an orchestra or something?
Pretending to play the tune.
Oh, nice.
Oh, the Nairobi Trio.
There you go, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. The music, oh, God, what was the music? Can't remember it to save me.
It'd be real good.
This is it. And it's all done as if they are automatonic. His wife, Edie Adams, is at the piano. Kovacs is conducting, seated in a chair, and Jack Lemmon is the third performer with the mallets that turns around and whacks Kovacs on the head.
God, man, I loved Lemmon. The world really did lose a great one when he passed on. Because we were back to Lee Remick again. I mean, that movie is so sad, but it's so good.
Yeah.
Those two. So everything, it all comes back, and it all comes back to Kurt Vonnegut. So here, I'm going to try to make this kind of quick. Plus, my cell phone, I know it has the worst microphone. But so I will try to come up with more of a radio voice.
Okay.
But one of the characters in the book now, his name is Stuart Buntline. And Stuart Buntline, reset this, he was born, he inherited a fortune as well. Not quite as big as the Rosewater fortune, but he's got quite a bit of money, and so he doesn't do anything, pretty much. But there was a time when he kind of thought about things and thought about his money, and he went to the law firm that represents him, who also had represented the Rosewaters. And so here in the book, we have a conversation here between this guy McAllister from the law firm and our friend here, Stuart, who decides that he wants to help the poor and he wants to give his money away. And that's important to him. And so the attorney says, he goes on, he leaves him this little thing like the Seventh Day Adventist would leave on your doorstep if you weren't home. Only this one says, he starts talking about, he leaves this for him because he is, he's afraid of, you know, that creeping socialism, Bob. They're just so afraid.
Yes. It never runs. It never, no, it creeps.
So he says here, he goes, have we really helped these people? Of course, he's referring to people who have less than them. He's referring to people on Social Security and welfare and all of it. He goes, have we really helped these people? Look at them. Consider this specimen who is the end result of our pity. What can we say to this third generation of people to whom welfare has long since become a way of life? Observe carefully our handiwork, whom we have spawned and are spawning by the millions, even in times of plenty. They don't work and will not. Heads down, unmindful, they have neither pride nor self-respect. They are totally unreliable. Not maliciously so, but like cattle who wander aimlessly. Foresight and the ability to reason have simply atrophied from long neglect. Talk to them, listen to them, work with them as I do. Remember, this is in 1965.
Right,
so
right.
We'll have to, some of this, we haven't been just, overwhelmed, tidal-waved with Reagan yet. But a guy with Vonnegut's perspective and perception, he's seen enough as it is. So he keeps talking. He says, work with them, and they've never worked with any poor people in their life. But I digress. And you realize with a kind of dull horror that they have lost all semblance of human beings except they stand on 2 feet and talk like parrots. More. Give me more. I need more. Are the only new thoughts they have learned. They stand today as a monumental caricature of Homo sapiens, the harsh and horrible reality created by us out of our own misguided pity. They are also, if we continue our present course, a living prophecy of what a great percentage of the rest of us will become. And the funny thing is about all this, you start thinking about just how these MFers, if I can use Sanders' one phrase.
Yes.
aren't you somewhat amazed at how the world has just done a complete 180? Because the oligarchs, they look at all of us, and it's almost like subconsciously they see themselves. Because that's exactly how they're describing us, is how they are. A bunch of, right, a self-serving, who all they want is more and more and more.
And it's that kind of, and I'll of course defer to the horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner on this, but that's the classic projection. And then you see the Republicans do it every day. They project their own conduct onto the rest of America that's trying to live a seemingly normal life. When it's themselves and their own hypocrisy that they're complaining about. If they fear socialized medicine, for instance, Reverbo, it's because they know what they would do with it if it was theirs. If they fear a boldly activist federal government, it's because they fear what would happen to them. Or they fear what they would become if they wielded that power. That's why through 8 years, while they did some stuff, they never completely finished the job. And not for want of time, but for want of courage. They project onto us what is, in the end, wrong with them.
Yeah. And the great thing is they also spend a hell of a lot of time trying to get us to pity them.
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, yeah, remember, Michelle Bachmann's not going to fill out the whole census because she's afraid that one is going to come and round her up and send her white butt to a concentration camp because, he has a secret plan to enslave all the white people.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. You got to feel so sorry for them because they messed up so bad. We're just going to have to give them more of our money. I mean, they really are successful at this whole pity campaign. Top to bottom, it's just almost unreal. And so I've said that sentence every time I call you. I said that sentence 3 times now. All these calls are the same. In some ways, it's kind of.
Now we work a theme. That doesn't make them the same.
No, you're right. Can I give you a little more Vonnegut before I?
Absolutely.
Before I hang up here, because it gets better here, because the attorney is really trying to explain to this guy. He's just confused, and in his patronizing way, he really kind of sets him straight on why wealthy people are like they are and why you really shouldn't have. We don't want to have any compassion for anybody, and I'll explain why, because essentially, because you'll just end up becoming like them. He does it in a few more words than that, So the guy comes in and he wants to give his money away, and the guy, I'll continue here, so the attorney says, so you want to be a saint, do you, young man? I didn't say that. I hope you didn't. I didn't imply it. You're in charge of what I inherited, money I did nothing to earn. The attorney says, well, I'll answer the first part of your question. Yes, we are in charge of what you inherited. In reply to the second part, if you haven't earned it yet, you will, you shall. You come from a family that is congenitally unable to fail to earn its way and then some. You'll lead, my boy, because you were born to lead, and that can be hell. He goes, what I'm telling you now is the world is full of suffering, and money can do a lot to relieve that suffering. Well, here's the guy is telling him, this is why he wants to give his money away. The world's full of suffering. The money can do a lot to relieve that suffering. I have far more money than I can use. I want to buy decent food and clothing and housing for the poor. And right away, the attorney says to him, and after you've done that, what would you like to be called? Sir Stewart or Saint Stewart? Saint Buntline? And so he goes on to say that he has been through this same silly argument with so many people before. One of the principal activities of this firm is the prevention of saintliness on the part of our clients. You gotta love that line. You can just
it is the function of virtually any silk stocking law firm.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because the nature of a law office is such that, from the solo practitioner doing the entailments in exchange for hickory nuts, all the way up to the, you know, $3,000 an hour crowd that invents stuff like derivatives and credit default swaps, it's all geared toward making sure nobody walks into the office and says, I got a whole bunch of money, it's a wonderful day, help me do the right thing with it. That never happens in a law office, Reverbo.
I've never heard of it happening.
People walk into a law office and say, here's my little beating heart in my hands, save me. Whether it's a corporate toxic polluter or somebody being tormented by, Walmart for medical bill payment.
So how about, you know, one of those unpleasant regulations that try to restrict how you pay corporate taxes and how you can restrict hiding your money offshore, where they come crying to their attorneys with that one, don't they?
Sure they do. And at the and the funny thing is, no matter who the client is, at the end of it all, if you catch them down to the watering hole, I paid them shyster lawyers. Could have done it myself. Nobody's ever, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. Said very famously, it is possible to live greatly in the law. He did not say it is likely you will live greatly in the law. Rooster Cogburn in True Grit refers to pettifogging lawyers. And it is a petty business. There are monumental amounts of money, and there's tons of advice on how to avoid saintliness. But it's one of those compartmentalized worlds, Reverbo, where there ain't a whole lot of happy. Some of the happiest people I know are people who used to be lawyers. Because it's like that refreshing moment when Darth Vader pulls off the mask. You know, and granted, he's ugly as hell, but he's finally free of the evil.
Enough.
It happens more than you might know. I mean, there are people out there who go and practice law for all they're worth for 15 years and then go, screw it! I've got enough! Now I'm going to go and sculpt my masterpiece and be what I really wanted to be, or I'm going to write a symphony or start a garage band or, you know, whatever.
I'm not against and that's fine with me. I mean, if you don't, that's okay, but, you know, if the system is so crappy that it corrupts, I mean, no matter how saintly you wish to become, if the system is just so corrupting, what's the point?
Yeah, and what's the point at the end of it all? Because all this, it all ends. somewhere on this planet, virtually every second of every day, if not even more frequently, the universe ends for some human being. And it's a concept that Vonnegut touched on there with Mr. Rosewater, and I can't remember if it was Sirens of Titan or which one it was where the little lawyer in the middle says, you know, if you can just get your hands on it as it passes through and take a drop out of a gallon, those drops will add up to more money than you can ever count.
Oh God, I do love that visual. It's almost like, you know, you got your pan in the creek, and there are those gold nuggets just flowing by.
Yeah, and if you just get the dust.
Yeah, well, it's a special pan that only lawyers have. You and I don't have that pan.
No, we don't. And Goldman Sachs has entire kitchen cabinets full of those pans.
Well, they got the beauties. They got the real expensive ones.
You know, the porcelain plated ones with the cubic zirconium encrusted edges.
But I wonder if this describes our friend Obama to some extent. Here we go. Every year, at least one young man whose affairs we manage comes into our office, wants to give his money away. Doesn't this sound like somebody who we know, somebody who wants to basically share his principles with us? He's completed his first year of some great university. It has been an eventful year. He has learned of unbelievable suffering around the world. He has learned of the great crimes that are at the roots of so many family fortunes. He has had his Christian nose rubbed, often for the very first time, in the Sermon on the Mount. He's confused, tearful, angry. He demands to know, in hollow tones, how much money he's worth, and we tell him. He goes haggard with shame. He says, you have, if I'm not mistaken, just completed 1 year at Harvard. The guy goes, yeah. The attorney says, it's a great institution, but when I see the effect it has on certain young people, I ask myself, how dare a university teach compassion without teaching history to? History tells us this, my dear young Mr. Buntline, if it tells us nothing else. Giving away a fortune is a futile and destructive thing. It makes whiners of the poor without making them rich or even comfortable. And the donor and his descendants become undistinguished members of the whining poor. Two great points on this, and again, remember, this was written, he wrote this in 1965.
Right.
Who is that a-hole, once again, Sandra is on my mind here, who described everyone as a bunch of whiners about a year ago? Remember him? One of our classy representatives, I believe?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so... That's wonderful when you see that. And the other thing is about the funniest part about Harvard is that, of course, anymore, you don't have to wait. There's no compassion 101 at any of the Ivy League schools. In my opinion, all those things do is they just teach you how to network your way to continue to grow and maintain your wealth. There are no compassion classes at those places anymore.
No, in the business department, I guess if you go for your MBA or if you go for a business degree of some sort, you have to, at some point you'll take a class laughably entitled Business Ethics. And that's as close as you get.
And it just describes this. I mean, I agree with all this, man. If you give away your money, you will become utterly ordinary. Unless you happen to be a genius. You're not a genius, are you? Guy says no. And genius or not, without money, you'll surely be less comfortable and free. Free. Not only that, but you will be volunteering your descendants for the muggy, sorehead way of life peculiar to persons who might have been rich and free had not a soft-headed ancestor piddled a fortune away. I mean, this guy is just... I mean, he, and of course it works because this character, Mr. Stuart Buntline, not soon after all of this, totally gave up any thoughts of compassion or sharing his wealth with anyone and spent his time basically doing nothing and drinking a lot of scotch. So, you can't, I don't know. I'm just so pissed. I'm so pissed off that Vonnegut didn't live to see, even with all Obama's faults. And I think Obama's fault is what is the fault of all the damn liberals. They're so idealistic. They don't want to behave like the Republicans. They just can't do it.
That's partly that, Reverbo, but it's also I don't know how much of an idealistic liberal Obama is. I think first and foremost, as Sandra mentioned, he's a product of the University of Chicago.
Yeah.
If there is a university in the United States that really, really, really does not have Compassion 101, it's the University of Chicago. This is the university that gave succor to Milton Friedman for a generation so that he could write those filthy, hate-filled poems about how working people must be made subservient to the free market, and how unions are an anathema to free market economics, and the market will provide. It's hard for any kind of liberalism to exist in that atmosphere, and he was faculty there. Okay, there's another side. This is a multifaceted coin, I suppose, and that is, as liberals, we don't want to be them, but we seem to have a hard time, Reverbo, if I may, telling the difference between being like them and being unafraid to beat them at their own game, because they are not one in the same thing.
No, and I think what we really wish, and I don't know if we've ever gotten that. We keep thinking that Obama's this guy, and again, time will tell when he will get tired of. You got to just throw Harry Reid into the pond, though. This is just ridiculous. But at some point, you want someone to. You want all the eloquent speeches, and you want all the idealism, and you want to remind yourself about why this country is so great, and why our Constitution is just such a great thing. And then after that, at the end of that speech, you want the person to say, "But right now, we're going to go kick some ass. And maybe when we're done, we can have that party, that idealistic party, and we can all, quote from the Constitution." And that's what you just don't see out of these people. It just, but you're right. There's no question that our educational system is, God, it is such a fault for this. Look, I mean, they're turning these people out. They turned out all the 60s people that gave us the Vietnam War, right? They turned out it's funny, they call that, they don't call that conservative economics. They call that neoliberal economics or something.
That's more fun with language, neoliberalism.
Yeah, I get all confused with this Ayn Rand business. But, I don't know. At Vonnegut, I mean, some people just have that ability to they're looking at the same thing I see, and they've already got it synthesized down to just the perfect salient points. Really about 30 seconds, and it's going to take me another couple of hours.
Yeah, it's artistry. Vonnegut books are not thick books, and you can play that game that many of us played there in the pews in the Baptist church during the boring parts of the service, where you just started flipping through the Bible and putting your finger on a verse and seeing what you got. And you can do that with a Vonnegut book, because everything's a gem. Everything is distilled. It comes across as light and breezy, and by the time, and then you go, holy crap, what did I just read? And you realize that he was operating on the same level as, who's the most famous Japanese poet of the Basho. He was operating on the same level as Basho. Words defined to their very essence of simplicity.
That's what poetry is. It's all, Hemingway could do that too. He, the shorter the sentence. I mean, I always admired that, how you could make your prose into poetry. You know, it seems like the theme of all these people that you tend to, I don't know, that makes all this so much more frustrating. It just comes down to, can capitalism and democracy coexist? I mean, isn't that pretty much what it boils down to? Is there any way for this to work?
And I think that's the ongoing inquiry. And more of us are saying no. But the problem is the debate has already been poisoned, Reverbo, because we've got segments of this society the people who are running the greed and avarice racket have built defenses around it, and they're competent defenses. So that any time that you say that there is a problem with capitalism, what you wind up with is somebody on the other side. See, he wants the dictatorship of the proletariat, and he's a communist.
Can't that work against them though, because of how they've managed to discourage critical thinking and discourage basically literacy? It seems to me there's a whole bunch of people that don't even have a clue what they're talking about.
Well, but
how does that work on anybody under the age of 50?
It does.
Well, and it doesn't, because they lost all those people under the age of 50. That's actually, as the statistics from the last election have showed us.
Oh, no. Well, maybe, but I mean, I got factual evidence from a week ago that says that is not an absolute truism, Reverbo. Because when you see a little fourth grader with a shaved head holding a sign that says, "Tree huggers, leave my daddy's job alone," that kid's not going to get well, Reverbo. And communist is going to work just fine on him. Because he's getting it 24/7.
Oh, he's just an empty vessel, Bob. And you could pour in all the good stuff, and instead his daddy's pouring in all the...
Right, but that's the good stuff is never going to get a chance. Especially, thinking back to last night, the principal of Williamson Middle School is a member of the Friends of Coal Ladies Auxiliary, which promotes this CEDAR program, Coal Education Development and Resources, or whatever it stands for. See, they take something filthy and nasty and they name it something pretty like a CEDAR.
And they're green typeface, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that kid's never going to get a chance to taste the good stuff. It's gonna be bile and vinegar for him for the rest of his days. And the best that he can hope for is that we tree huggers will leave his daddy's job alone so he can quit high school at 16 years old and go drive a D9 Caterpillar.
I was going to say to leave him free to aspire to that same lofty life his daddy has. Wow, yeah, that's great. I enjoy talking to you tonight. I wanted to tell you though how sweet it was when you were describing the standing in line for the waiting to get into the hearing room, and you guys remembered pretty much what your mama told you and what Bear Bryant's mama told him. You know. You don't really want to show up in court looking like a gangster, looking like a dirtball. And you waited there, and it was uncomfortable. And first of all, I don't understand why there weren't 3,000 seats in there, but there's a lot I don't understand.
Well, it's just a subcommittee room, so, they generally don't get a lot of traffic.
I guess not. But it was so sweet. You guys finally filed in, sat down, and all these clodhoppers with their, who didn't even use deodorant that morning. I can just picture these people. I mean, it's like, once again, I hate physical stereotypes, but I'm telling you, everybody knows who we're talking about here. You think you're making just a real big point of what a working man you are, because you didn't take a bath this morning or shave, and you tore your pants in half.
And again, it's another case of projection that you described earlier, Reverbo.
I don't like it.
They describe us as dirty DFHs, dirty hippies,
right?
Out of staters, tree huggers, because that all implies a sort of seediness.
dirty.
And lo and behold, that's how they show up. You know, like I said, there's that slideshow that Antrim Kasky put up over at climategroundzero.org, and one of those photos shows the Fockers standing in the hall, all in their little matching T-shirts.
The caps.
The ball caps. Down the way, you can see the fellow standing there. I guess somewhere between Logan, West Virginia, and Washington, D.C., he ripped the sleeves out of his T-shirt so he could show his flabby, manly, tattooed biceps. And he's standing there in jean shorts.
Oh, yeah. This is the uniform. This is their base. The uniform of their base is essentially...
You know, we're the DFHs, but they're the ones who look like road apples.
Well, I don't. Once again, now we're at this cognitive dissonance that always happens when I talk to you. Is I start out everybody's happy and we just end up all confused. And once again, I have to deal with the idea that none of this should work. It doesn't make any sense. It's unreasonable. It lacks all compassion and humanity. And at the same time, I have to put up with the fact that evidently it seems to work and they're going to be blowing up more mountains tomorrow. So, good luck.
Well, it's working short term, but it's the great weight of public opinion nationally is against it. You know, my God, you know, it's only happening in West Virginia by virtue of political corruption reverbo. Up to 80% of West Virginians oppose this. But our government facilitates it anyway. How can anybody in the state government, with anything approaching a straight face, call that representative democracy?
These people are on the take. They always have been. I hope Obama is just less on the take.
Well, and you know, there was a whole blog day on Sunday that was dedicated to folks blogging, begging Barack Obama to come to Appalachia like LBJ went to Martin County, Kentucky in 1967.
Well, that would be outstanding.
Well, you know what? By the time, I can't count the number of times that George W. Bush came to West Virginia to promote the blowing up of the mountains and the right-wingism. You know, he came here for a 4th of July festival on the grounds of the state capitol that was a campaign stop that he used West Virginia state funds to cover. And Barack Obama can't show up in West Virginia not once so far. The man's been, I mean, I'm not trying to be an ass or anything. I love to take my wife out once in a while. It happens all too rarely. So I understand the wonder of being able to take your wife to Paris or even to a Broadway show. Jesus, if I can take my wife out for pizza by ourselves, it's a flipping miracle. I understand all that. But President Obama, sometimes the trips aren't fun. Sometimes you have to come to a place like West Virginia and see what half measures get you. Because that's all we're getting on this issue is half measures. And half measures don't work. You know, if you go over to WVGazette.com and click on Cole Tattoo and scroll down a little ways, you'll see Cole wins another one. In the midst of all the Sturm und Drang about the climate change bill, the United Mine Workers had to come out and say, hey, this works for us. Coal's going to be here. Coal's just fine with this bill. And yet people with UMWA caps show up in Washington, D.C. last Thursday saying they're trying to take my job.
Your reference to Germany, sometimes you have to visit Buchenwald and you have to visit Auschwitz. You can't always visit Paris. Obama ought to take a little trip over there and see what used to be beautiful is now ugly. That would be something.
You know, you remind me that I need to mention something. You know, Saturday at the very least, perhaps Sunday as well. But Saturday, the family and I are going to mark the second year of what has become a family tradition. Instead of going over to the local carnival and, you know, eating the partially cooked frozen corn dogs that are $6 a piece with little packets of mustard and waiting until 10:30 at night when it's finally dark enough for the fireworks and probably getting rained on, we're going to go to Larry Gibson's place on Cayford Mountain for the Mountain Keepers Music Festival. And I'm going to, you know me, it's going to be frustrating because my smoker is a POS. But I'm going to try to get a couple of pork shoulders on the smoker a couple of days ahead of time and make it just tender, fork fall apart, tender pulled pork barbecue and make my famous homemade, not famous sauce. And here's the fun part. Guess what?
What?
The Friends of Cole have said that they are going to invade.
Oh, really? Coming with their... I'm sure they're going to bring the corn dogs, I'm sure.
Yeah.
The two-foot-long chili dogs.
Jesus. You know, and it's just a bunch of people who are committed to trying to save what's left of West Virginia. People will come from all over. I met some wonderful people last year, horn listeners. You know, camp out on Larry's property, lots of good music played, that kind of stuff, big old picnic dinner. And the Friends of Cole have said that they are going to come and do us violence.
Why?
Because we're no good out-of-state DFH tree huggers who are trying to take our job. Never mind the fact that Larry Gibson's lived on that property since he was born. Never mind the fact that most of the people there will be 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th generation Appalachian. They're going to come teach us a lesson. You know, we couldn't even keep them out of our rally last week. That was supposed to be our rally. State police said, no, sorry. Public place, we can't keep them out. We'll just try to keep the peace. And in the course of keeping the peace, Goldman Environmental Prize winner Judy Bonds was punched in the head by a Massey wife out of her mind with rage.
Yeah.
My wife had a beringed, doubled up, double fist driven into the small of her back. My son was called various and sundry names.
Mm-hmm.
An Episcopal priest was accused of wanting to have sex with children.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I got a couple of faggot tree hugger.
Well, sure.
And yet, you know, we're the dangerous ones.
Well, you know, the president, he did visit that that Virginia Denny's. Just, you need to go on The Onion and go see the video of that trip. It forced an entire reconsideration of his whole, the whole plan, the whole stimulus plan, really.
Yeah, Denny's.
I'm trying to end this on a humorous note.
I know.
I strongly advise you to look that one up, my friend.
I will.
Oh, God, it's good. There are people laying on the... 2 pounds of pork sausages and maple syrup, and he's rethinking the whole thing.
Well, we just got to the food porn portion of the program.
All right. Well, we have to say this, because it's always like this. Make it personal.
Make it personal. Exactly.
I'll talk to you later.
All right. Take care, Reverbo. Thanks for the Vonnegut. It's always an uplift.
All right.
Bye now. Horn critic at large, Reverbo, and we roll on. Hey, welcome to the program.
I have to ask, are you scared of this get-together in July?
No.
No? Not even with the threats?
All I can do is kill me.
Well, I guess.
I mean, we got laws against them eating me.
Well, I guess, and...
No, I mean, you have to be cognizant. You have to be careful.
Yeah, I know. I'm just thinking, you know, I was just thinking, that's something.
And knowing how they operate, they will operate in the dark and still of the night and slash tires and the attack tents and things like that, because that's the kind of sneak thief and dark and still of the night kind of people they are.
And the authorities won't do anything.
We didn't see it. We can't prove it.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. See, something like that I think...
But the nice thing is, you know, the people who are there, who will be there, are all very much plugged into the digital generation. And while there's no cell phone coverage up there, and there's right. damn sure no internet, it will all be documented. Someone, whatever is done, they will get. You know, and these morons probably don't realize that, for instance, most Sony video cams have something on it called Night Shot. That's basically, it turns the camera into an infrared video camera.
Yeah, it's too bad about that angle with Judy Bonds getting punched. It's really like to the side, and it's really, really quick, so you kind of see it, but I guess it's one of those moments where you got to be there to really...
Yeah, well, there's one that has it slowed down several times that you can find.
Speaking about the President Obama, I've come to a conclusion that this man is completely emotional tone deaf. And the way I see it is he has to be emotional tone deaf out of necessity, or he'll go mad in the position that he's in.
Well, he wants this. Look, let's engage in a little political realism, David. He wants this. The day you take the oath of office on the first term, you start wanting the second one.
Oh, exactly. I know.
And so that precludes his ability politically to, even if he knows what the right answer is, do it, because it will be contrary to his second term or the likelihood thereof.
I understand that, but, you know, it's like signs that I see. When you're in an economic crisis, just to give you an example, if this was Bush, I always throw that out there because it's always a good perspective.
That's a benchmark standard for the 21st century.
If this was Bush and he went on a vacation to Martha's Vineyard during one of America's greatest economic crises, we would a lot of us would be feeling a certain negative reaction to that. Now, when I see Obama's family, and he deserves his family vacation, but you know, the two words, Bob, Martha's Vineyard, it doesn't gel well with a public that's struggling.
No.
That's why I go back to the fact that I do think this guy is emotionally tone deaf. He's been living in D.C.ville for a long time.
Well, and not even, you know, D.C.ville or University of Chicagoville.
Well,
when you get confronted with political realities, and, you know, deals were made, you know, David Axelrod, you know, Rahm Emanuel, they were all part of the team. They helped it happen.
Right.
So necessarily they get to play. And in the course of that, they affect how things go down. And so you wind up with the, well, you know, Mr. Obama, what we can do is we can tighten up the regulations and we can make sure that mountaintop removal is done responsibly. Oh, okay, that sounds good. No, there's no such thing as responsible mountaintop removal. That's like there's no such thing as responsible bigotry and don't ask, don't tell, because it's bigotry. There's no such thing as responsible racism. And anything that you approach from this, we're going to do half a loaf attempt, is doomed. You know, we're going to do stimulus, but we're going to give a lot of corporate welfare away at the same time. No!
I think what we're experiencing right now in this country is a paralyzing fear. Of complacency, of corporations have done it for so long that let's just imagine, Bob, if the corporations were, I want people to imagine with me, if the corporations were to pack up and call it a day, all of a sudden they were gone from America, we wouldn't have a good day that day.
But wait. How much would be gone?
No, but here's what I'm saying.
The TVs and the computer stuff and all, it's all made in China.
Yeah, exactly. I understand that. But what I'm saying is we look at it from a point of an outsider's perspective. But when you're in the driver's seat, you get to know how the controls handle, and you get to know that there are risks when you're operating this machinery. So my point is the fact that I think that here's my thing about it. It's like you have a genie and you say, I wish for no corporations. It would be such a better world if we didn't have any corporations. Well, the demands that we put on ourselves, the conditioning that we have right now, I think it would be a disaster. Unlike a magnitude we've ever seen before, if that were to happen. So that's partly why the reason why I think we do have corporations in place. And also I would say that it is, to me, when we look at, we don't put enough under the microscope for ourselves as citizens. And what I'm saying is we make the decision every day of how we want to lead our lives and how we want our lives to be seen from there, a perspective for other people. And my thing is that we're making the choices with everything we do, whether we go to Walmart, whether we go to Sam's, whether we buy this computer and that computer, and whether we get cable, and we've continued to accept this society. So there is that complicity involved. And then, you know, you have to start thinking and you have to start realizing that, okay, there's going to be so much sacrifice that we're going to have to deal with in order for the world to get how we want. And that's the lie that is being told to us by a lot of people who are considered progressive, because they say there isn't going to be that much sacrifice. No, there's going to be a lot of sacrifice for the things that we want. It's going to have to happen if that's what you want. It's going to be blood, sweat, and tears and more. And that's what we're not told. And see, that's the problem. I guess what I'd like to see, and it's a naive thing, if I saw a leader who didn't promise me anything, that's how I know we're in for trouble. When someone promises me something, or someone gives me this whole vision of how they see the world, instead, to me, I see it from perspective, I'd rather see a leader just say, you know what, we're in a really tough situation. Obviously can't say it on the TV cameras. Let's see what happens. Let's see what we can do. Instead of this rigmarole that we're told, and I mean, we feed into it so easily, this fantasy. And I guess that's what I'm looking at from that point of view right now, because I don't know what I would do if I had the reins of the country. I don't know. How much risk, let me ask you a question, how much risk would you put on yourself for these decisions you make? What would you do? Where would you start?
The easy answer, David, is you ran for the job, you wanted the job, do the job.
I know, but I'm talking about in any position of power, when you're in there and you have that optimistic side to you, and you have that positive side to you, how much risk are you willing to put on the table for things that you want to get done? And that's the way I'm starting to look at things. And really, it is kind of a tragic sense, because we don't have a lot of gamblers out there, and maybe that's a problem. We don't have the same kind of high rollers that they do on the Republican side. I don't think Harry Reid would walk into a casino. That's my point of view.
No, because the House always wins, and Harry knows that.
Well, a symbolic type of casino where you put on a serious, where you have a risk in mind. Republicans did take risks in the beginning, and Democrats have taken risks in the past as well. But I mean, there is this this opening that we see. We have the 60th in the Senate, and you know, it goes back to, okay, if they don't give us health care and they don't give us any of these things, I heard on Hartman today, and I've said it before, there's going to be a backlash, and people aren't going to want to vote for Democrats. So I have no idea why they wouldn't even be putting up a show right now, because you're just ticking off the base right now.
And that's the argument, and it's a valid one, David, namely that the Democrats are in Congress are operating in hopes of preserving and perhaps expanding power, as opposed to operating in such a way as to get the job done. You know, you got to give it to the Republican Party. They did pursue their ideology, and they did it with ham-fisted determination.
And that's why I think the Republicans are one of the smartest marketers in this whole thing. I mean, they still have my dad's veterans friends wound up. Even after, don't buy the percentage people, because it's true. They have that mind control that we seem to lack.
Well, that's because the right wing is authoritarian in nature.
Well, yeah, I don't think they woke up one day and said, you know, let's be authoritarians. I think it came eventually a progress to it. Now, but on the other side of things, the Democrats have that in them as well. Now, that's the question. Do they want to be authoritarian? It goes back to what Sandra was saying about Naomi Klein and shock doctrine and the bubble machine and all of that. That's the question. Do the Democrats want to be authoritarian? Because I'll say this. There's a great quote in Alan Moore's Watchmen. The world is basically in almost... It's in complete disarray. Nixon is president. He's in his third term. And this right-winger, crazy superhero is shooting up the place. And this guy, and one of the superheroes who is realized he's completely disillusioned, and he says to him, he goes, "What happened to the American dream?" And the guy, without missing a beat, who calls himself a comedian, before he shoots a citizen on the street, he says, he looks at him and he goes, "It came true."
Ooh.
Now, when I say that, I say, if we're leading in that direction, I'm starting to see the signs that that's the direction that the Democrats want to take us in as well. Because if you think about it, they'll look at it as like, yeah, it'll be a lot of destruction and it'll be a lot of problems in this country. But ultimately, we'll have a sense of order and control that wasn't there.
And there you, and that's the, and that's the easy road to fascism.
I know. But then, but they start to reason that it isn't fascism.
No, it's patriotism.
What is that?
Patriotism.
Yeah, patriotism. They'll start to define it as something else. And you know, what was the other thing? You notice how the military is marketed now? That was another thing I was going to say that I didn't say the other day. There's this great piece they talk about on anti-war about this libertarian who talks about the Department of Defense. And one of his main points, although you may not agree with the libertarian philosophy, is how the Democrats and the liberals and the neoliberals, whatever you want to do it, how they've taken up the mantra, the framework of the Department of Defense. And in this, he was way ahead of his time. I think his name was Melman. Anyways, he says that when they push it into the school and the framework, it's the reason why you see MIT, they completely, it's almost like an obeisant reason for why they have the Department of Defense. And they explain to you why this is necessary. But really, there is no reason why that's there. It was placed there. And what he basically is talking about is the fact that when you have an arm or an invisible hand that comes into our country like that, and immediately it's seen as a necessity, it just creeps through everything, and people don't realize that that's pretty much is what's leading us down that road to destruction, so to speak, as a country. And one of the things that he kept saying was, he kept saying that we never, if you're not going to face up to the Department of Defense, if the Democrats or the Republicans aren't going to do that, he goes, it's going to be maddening. And I mean, he was saying this back in 1940 and 1930. So, you know, I've looked at what's happening along the lines on Huffington Post, what I've heard from Montel Williams and stuff like that, and I've heard a lot of stuff on Air America, even on some networks, other networks that I won't say.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I hear that. I hear that. Yes, the defense is a necessity. And then you hear that. Yes, well, today is the day that the Iraqis have to step up and secure their country. And it's, I don't know, it's really insane when you think about it, because you think, okay, really, whose fault is it? Is the Pentagon, is the defense, is the military? That's who decided on the mission. But they change it in such a way that it's deviant brilliance.
But see, for instance, the Pentagon, I don't, there's no one more willing to criticize the Pentagon than I am, David.
Right.
But Iraq was not the Pentagon's idea. Iraq was the Bush administration's idea. Iraq was the idea of the Project for a New American Century.
Right.
And that's why Iraq wound up such a mess, because the Pentagon, you know, remember, Bush cashiered a high-ranking general who said, you know what? You don't want to do this, and we're not ready for it. Goodbye! Enjoy your retirement. Be grateful we didn't court-martial you while we're at it.
And that's part of the problem, though, is that we keep passing, as a country, we keep passing the excuses that we have for, but it wasn't the Pentagon, it was the Bush administration. Everyone had a role in it, and eventually you have to look at the bigger picture and say, somebody wanted something out of this, and they didn't care about the destruction, and they didn't care about the genocide, and they wanted this to happen. So ultimately, you have to look and go, you know, I'm just not buying what you're saying. You're a merchant of death, for God's sakes, on a hill that we should have dismantled a long time ago. And I guess that's what...
Well, see, David, you were talking about backlash a minute ago. Got an email rolling in from our buddy Cindy.
Yeah.
And she says, the way I see it, the liberals, the left, the hardcore progressives pounded out this presidential win, and then we were cast to the curb while the DLC took over, gathering all the congratulations. Therefore, she asks, if we don't, and this is all in caps, but I won't yell it. If we don't get single payer, I quit the party.
You know what? That's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, what else is there? I'm not going to be for a party that's going to go lockstep with the military for a conflict in Afghanistan, for a conflict anywhere. I don't see, that's the insulting thing, Bob. The insulting thing is we put our time, we put our energy into this, into promoting and marketing. You know, in a sense, we're like A&Rs, and in a sense, we're like a salesman, a marketing representative. And what do we get for it? We get virtually nothing for it. And that's my point. It's like, so they're going to invest it all in the military. This is what we need to have. We need to have this kind of direct talk, one-on-one talk. You're going to invest it all in the military. Let me get this straight. And you expect us to just keep voting your line because...
Right, but because the for-profit media, among others, David, are so effective at dividing the American people and saying, no, look at this hand, look at this hand, while the other hand is doing something nasty.
Mm-hmm.
We don't ask questions, for instance, the little drum that I've been beating on. How much good could we do with $60 billion that we're putting into a technological boondoggle called carbon capture and storage? How much good could that $60 billion be if it was included in the calculations for some sort of single-payer option? And we don't get to ask that question. Because everything is so neatly and tidily compartmentalized.
And then
so that, you know, that's the Pentagon budget, and we can't... Dennis Kucinich said 5 years ago, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically we could shake out the sofa at the Pentagon and come up with enough money to do single-payer health care. And he's right. Just by eliminating the waste, fraud, and abuse, we could have some of the things that we desperately want and need. But it's a question of priority, and it's a question of political will. When your first day on the job, when they say, "Mr. President, congratulations on your victory. Now this is how it works."
Well, then that brings me to the question, Bob, that I'm not just thinking of the Republicans now. I'm thinking of the Democrats as well. I'm thinking of anyone in D.C., matter of fact, that maybe the real veil underneath that is it's better to have us be sick than to be completely healthy and strong and able and willing. You have, in their eyes, if you have a half-sick population, you have a population that isn't...
That is malleable and controllable and manipulable.
And to me, that's just... Wow, I mean, to really just think about that in terms of, I just got to go back to what Naomi Klein was saying about disaster capitalism. And I think the Democrats, as much as it kind of pains me to say this, I think the Democrats are falling in line with disaster capitalism models as well.
Any look at this pathetically weak, ineffective. The climate change bill has to confirm that. Hey, David, I got to roll along, brother.
All right, Bob.
All right, we'll talk soon. All right.
Bye now.
And that is our pop culture correspondent, David, calling from Maine. Rolling onward. Oh, you didn't wait. Hey, welcome to the program.
I waited.
Ah, very good, Dave. How are you?
I'm buried up under the strain is probably the best way I can put it, but I won't bore you with the detail. No, I was just listening, Life's been getting in the way for a while. I keep meaning to get on here, but there's been so much going on, I've not had a chance.
I know the feeling completely. I was totally out of the loop for a couple of days in D.C. There was no time to, you try to jump online long enough to find out that Michael Jackson's dead, and you go, well, what else is going on in the world? Well, nothing. Michael Jackson's dead.
I got aging parents in England with stuff to deal with, and I got potential custody battle here and layoffs at work, So life's fairly stressful at the moment, but... We'll get there. We'll be all right. Just listening to the last thing about, if we got rid of corporations, that would be a bad thing. Well, maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. But one of the things I would say about corporations is, if you want to keep them, make them accountable. It's really straightforward. They're given the rights and privileges of a person. If I, as a person, commit an illegal act and somebody dies, it's called murder and I get a life sentence. If a corporation causes the death of somebody by an illegal act, its corporate charter should vanish. They're right there. That's smarting them up real fast.
Yeah, it would. And that's the thing. Corporations are a human. They are not a person, but they are a human construct, as is any other sociological. It's in the nature of human beings to gather together for a common purpose, whether it be building posters, making tires, or yoga.
Radio stations.
Yeah. It's all in how you manage it. Santa Clara County versus Union Pacific Railroad, where a footnote created the idea of corporate personhood.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the intent going in that's important, not how it's managed. I think the intent going in is the important issue.
Well, look at the classic case.
To maximize profit. No matter what, then what we're dealing with on the planet right now is an inevitable result. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that, I don't think.
Well, there are even different approaches, Dave, to how you maximize profit and how that is defined. If you maximize profit for next quarter's statement, but you're bankrupt in the quarter after that, you've not maximized profit. But according to American rules, you have. On the other hand, there are corporations in other countries.
Even jobs to China, you've done well, according to.
Right. You know, in other countries, there are corporations that actually define maximizing profit as what happens for the buy and hold crowd who are going to hold the stock for a long time and realize significant gains over time. We, you know, at American culture is the want it now culture. We're like something out of well, I mean, obviously Roald Dahl was talking about somebody when he created the whole allegory of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we want it now. We are instant gratification.
Not only do we want it now, we want it with no thought of the consequence.
Consequence.
I can afford to buy a Hummer, and I can afford to put gas in it. And I can afford to drive it across Canada. Does that mean I've got the right to do that just because I can afford to do it?
Or well, under the American model, it does.
Exactly. And that's the problem. It's people's lack of thought about the consequences of their actions that's screwing the world up, and it has done for a long time. Now, people have been kept deliberately out of the loop by the corporate press. We all know that. People who go to school get schooled. They don't get educated. As long as you can press the right buttons and shove the right bits of paper across the desk, the corporate monster's quite happy with the education you've got. That's not an education in my eyes. That's schooling. And that's what I say to my kids. Go to school, you'll get school. Come on.
Education is what happens between your ears.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you can choose to educate yourself, or you can choose to watch the sports and watch the reality TV, and all that stuff. You know, I mean, I'm rabidly anti-television. I think it's an incredibly powerful medium that's been grabbed by the wrong people. I mean, if television was used as a force for education and an advancement of the human spirit, I'd be all for it, and it could do that. It's powerful enough to affect that. But right now, as we all know, it's controlled by, back to the word, corporation. You know? And they use television to propagandize, to try and make themselves look good, and, you know, to bullshit the populace, basically. That's what television's all about, and that's why I hate it and won't have one. You know? And until people stop falling for the, you know, falling for the trick, there's no hope. People are not informed. People have no bloody clue what's going on.
All right, so you set the parameters for the change, Dave. What is it that makes people stop falling for it then? Are we such, you know, in line with the text that Reverbo was sharing from Kurt Vonnegut, are we all simply pathetic messes?
No.
The poor people are poor and you can't help them, and it's, you know, straight out of the Bible, and the poor you have always with you. What I'm asking is, you know, does something, the last time we had any significant move toward a change in this country was the Great Depression. And the only reason Franklin Roosevelt pursued the policies that he pursued was because there was no other way.
Well, there were other ways, but he was scared shitless of what they were.
Yeah, well, there was no other way within the parameters of how we define the United States of America.
Yeah. But that's the thing. I mean,
does it have to be pitchforks and torches?
Communist, but it absolutely wasn't. But that was part of the propaganda. So people now have been beaten into them so badly that Stalin was a communist. Was he hell a communist? He was a dictator, and he didn't give a stuff. He didn't care about his people.
He was a totalitarian.
Exactly. So to try and say that the USSR was a communist state is crap. But it's that, like you were saying earlier, watch this hand. Well, that's one of the hands that was stuffed in your face during the Cold War. Was this guy that the USSR was communist? Was it hell communist? It was just a totalitarian regime where there was an elite that ran the place. That sounds vaguely familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah, kind of.
Really, what was the difference? I mean, the methods used to control the populace were slightly different and slightly
Well, I mean, shall we, it's less acceptable, reasonable, you know. I mean, if you're destroying somebody's life, does it matter how you're doing it?
Does it matter if he was killed by a fascist or a communist or an anarcho-syndicalist or a, right?
Whatever, if you, you know. Yeah, exactly. And what
face down in the mud, they stink the same way after 3 days in the heat.
Yeah, and one of the things I used to say during the Cold War in the UK, I lived, like I said to you before, I lived at the end of one of the long, well, what was at the time the longest runway in Europe. So I knew what was going to happen if anything went weird. But one of the things that I always used to say when they were saying, well, we've got nuclear weapons to protect your freedom, I thought, well, if I've just been vaporized, freedom just became really academic.
Yes.
You know?
And I mean, that's the nature of that comment I made a little bit ago about the universe ends every second for somebody on this planet. And if we don't come to grips with that, everything else is, and I mean, I'm not saying that that's the be-all and end-all, but it's kind of hard to get a grip on some sort of objective reality if we don't understand the fleeting nature of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many things. Like I was writing, scribbling notes while I was waiting on the phone, which is what I do, because otherwise I'll forget half of what I was going to say. But when you know, we're talking about the military, right now what's happening with unemployment is a recruiter's dream, a military recruiter's dream. Boost unemployment and then offer people jobs in the military. Woohoo! How to militarize the country really well and really quickly and really, you know, with very little effort. Destroy jobs, and then the only jobs you offer, have a gun in your hand. Great way of keeping those wars going.
Indeed. You know,
that's what's happening, I believe.
Sure it is. It's a racket.
Yeah, because how much does the average artillery shell cost, let's say? Just ballpark a number. Say, let's $1,000.
$1,000.
So let's say that's 50% profit for some company somewhere like Raytheon or whoever. It doesn't really matter, you know. Lockheed, whatever. It doesn't matter, you know. One of the group of satanic organizations on the planet, really. So every time a shell gets fired, so that's $500 profit. Woohoo! War is the ultimate consumer. That's why we need so much of it.
Well, war is the ultimate bull market.
Yes.
Because death is always in demand, and there's always someone out there willing to profit by it. And we talk about changing models and talking about changing, you know, how we approach things. That's one of those fundamental things we have to take a look at.
Yeah, and the banks fund both sides, don't they?
Sure they do.
So,
you know, we had to go and
from it, you want lots of it happening.
We had to go and kill Saddam Hussein
by using the Federal Reserve to do so. Then you're laughing. You've got the game nailed, and that's where we're heading right now.
Yeah, we had to go and kill Saddam Hussein because he was too well armed. And we knew he was too well armed because we sold him to him.
Well, exactly. All the chemical weapons that he used against the Kurds were supplied by the likes of Monsanto. And Union Carbide and all those guys.
Yeah, never forget
so
that
photo. As long as they were making money, they had no problem.
Right.
But then he stopped playing ball. That was what he did wrong. He didn't do anything wrong in terms of military, human rights, any of that stuff. He stopped playing ball with the corporate monster.
Well, and more importantly, anything he did do wrong in terms of human rights was winked at. As long as he was playing in our ballpark.
Yeah.
I mean, do you remember Manuel Noriega?
Oh, don't I mean, do you remember? You know, just go back through history. Mossad agonist. When the Americans are claiming they're not interfering in Iran. Come on.
No, come on. No, the Bush administration.
Night.
Yeah, the Bush administration admitted they were funding the dissident groups in Iran.
Like I say, I was born at night, but not last night. Come on, I'm not stupid. But people are, again, back to the monster and the control of media. If you're prepared to be spoon-fed the information that you get, somebody's going to say, woohoo, I'll spoon-feed you quite happily, because I give you the information I want you to have, and you'll do what I want you to do. And we, you know, I mean, it's so, all you have to do is just read two different newspapers to make that really obvious to yourself. You know? I don't know. I'm finding that I'm at a complete loss as to why the world's such a shitty mess. I really am at a loss as to how people can let what's happening happen. I mean, I feel completely powerless. Completely. I feel like voting is a waste of paper and pencil lead.
At least you get the paper and the pencil lead.
Well, yeah, but you know what I go down to the voting booth every time we have an election. I always write on it, none of the above, thank you very much, the process thing, and I put that in. But that's just recorded as a spoiled vote. But that just is so that people can't see me say to me, you didn't make the effort. I did make the effort. I voted how I felt. But all it gets counted at is a spoiled vote. Now, is that something that I'm doing wrong, or is that something that the setup is doing wrong? That would be my question.
Well, and I think the answer is obvious.
You know? So I do go down there. I do make my feelings known, not with an X.
You know, every now and then I talk amongst our friends here in West Virginia. And because politics is something that I follow and try to understand and comprehend, I've got this little tin drum that I keep beating, Dave. And I say, who are we going to run against, fill in the blank, in the primary next election?
Well, you see, the problem with the U.S. is you have a two-party system.
Right, because November's no good.
It excludes anything but the status quo. So you get the status quo. Simple as that. It really is, to me, as simple as that. And the UK's gone the same way. You look at the UK. When in the early 80s, when you had Labour government and Conservative government, you had evil incarnate Thatcher. I mean, her and Reagan destroyed the planet. Slowly, but they did, between them. And one of the things that I remember during the miners' strike in the UK was, I think it was an absolutely deliberate decision to destroy mining communities. Communities, that's what they were destroying, because they didn't want someone to be able to rely on their community for help. They wanted them to be reliant on the government so that they could then control it. And that's why those communities were destroyed. And that's what's been happening for the longest time. It's divide and conquer. And when people say, well, those car workers were getting too much money, no, they weren't. They were getting what everybody should be getting. We should have been saying, they're getting it, we want it. Not that we're not getting it, so they shouldn't have it.
Right. It's an upside-down paradigm.
Yeah.
But it's also devilishly difficult to make that a reality for the American people.
Because the media control them.
Right, because, you know, the poor are constantly, you're supposed to be worried half sick for all of your life. You're not supposed to live a life of leisure. You know, your life is to be nasty, brutish, and short.
Yeah, so that we can have fun. Eat the rich.
Roast them on a spit. Yep.
You know, I mean, there's a song by Midnight Oil. There is enough. You know, there is enough for everyone. The only reason there's poverty on the planet is because of the greedy bastards at the other end.
Right, it's like that old bumper sticker slogan. Live simply so that others may simply live.
Yeah. And that's something I really try to follow. I mean, I live small. I put $40 worth of gas in my car a week ago last Saturday. That's my way of... I try and minimize driving.
We do the same thing here.
I could rush out and buy a smart car, but that would feed the monster. I mean, I drive an old thing. My car's 10 years old.
Ha, gotcha beat. Mine's 15 years old.
I only drive when I have to, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's my way of reducing my carbon footprint. Don't drive. If I can pedal it or walk it, I do. If I'm going down somewhere and
in my world, it is still a dream, and it's only a dream, but it's a dream that has some sort of underpinning that I hope will someday come true. I so badly want to take this house solar and wind that I can taste it. I want to walk out on the front porch every morning and like some sort of religious adherent. I want to face wherever the corporate headquarters of Appalachian Power is and do my holy bit of obeisance and go...
Exactly, yeah. I fart in your general direction.
Your mother was a hamster and your father smelt of elderberries. You're damn right.
Exactly. You know, that's the thing. You know, it would be so nice. I mean, I live in an apartment for various reasons. And where I live is really nice. I don't like being in an apartment. But I'd love to go solar. Years back in the 70s in the UK, I had a book about building your own place and going off-grid. And it was one of the ideas there was, Put your house on the ground for starters, and grow veggies on the roof. But have a pool in the middle, and glass all around, so that wherever the sun is, you're getting it, and it heats the water in the middle, and then you run a heat pump out of there.
Well, yeah, and look, I mean, the state of Colorado just now passed a law saying it's okay to collect rain.
Mm-hmm.
Based, you know, they overturned 100 years of arcane law saying that it was a crime to collect rain.
Ah, but you know what will happen next, though, don't you? As we warm up, mosquitoes will start living in that collected rain, and so you'll have to fill it with pesticides to kill the mosquitoes off. That'll be the upcoming law.
Well, but the most of these catchment systems are covered, you know. I mean, and the thing is, this house where we live was sustainable long before sustainable was cool. There was a gravity-fed dual cistern system here, and every gutter was guttered into that cistern system, and it washed the clothes, and it was not used for drinking. That's what the well was for.
Yeah, but have you seen an ad that Britain have been using? And interestingly, I saw it a couple of days ago, you know, where they put the ads in the little cart you shove around the supermarket.
Right.
And it was basically saying you should just filter the water you wash your hair with, because the water that you flush your toilet with is the same stuff. And to me, that was like, well, okay, I can see what you're trying to do. You're trying to make the water look dirty, but really what you're saying is we shouldn't be using that water to flush the toilet. We should be catching rainwater to do that. You know, but this is, again, back to the corporate monster and the way they work.
Exactly.
You can control the answer you get by the question you ask to a large extent with a lot of people. One of the things I always find that I do is I look at the logic of the question, and that's not what.
Well, right, because if you frame the question in a fraudulent fashion, the answer by definition has to be fraudulent as well.
Yeah, and again, this is a line in a Billy Talent song. When you're feeling insecure, they'll find the fuel to start the fire. You know. One of the things I remember saying to my daughter when she first kind of started looking at makeup, I stood her in front of the mirror and I said, "What do you see there?" She said, "What do you mean?" I said, look, straight in front of you, what do you see? She said, "Me." I said, "Yeah, exactly." I said, "Does that look awful? Does that look really horrible?" I said, "No, you're fairly lucky in that regard. You know, you're at the front of the queue and they'll give the faces out, or really close to it." Said, so don't try and become one of these things that you see on a magazine. She bought the first kind of whatever the hell these magazines are. That's what made me do this. Said, you can't walk around behind Photoshop. So you cannot achieve what these people are trying to sell you, no matter how much money you give them. And that's what it's all about.
Absolutely true.
And it's that kind of logic that There's a great magazine. Have you seen a magazine called Adbusters?
Yes.
Yeah, a great magazine. Never miss it. And the approach in there is sensible. I mean, it's a bit dramatic at times, and some of the people that write in are a bit too into the kind of the scene, I think. I find there's a little bit of that in there. But generally speaking, it's pretty good stuff. I mean, it does really get down to the heart of a lot of things. And I leave that lying around all the time, and, you know, the kids will read that. And that's just my way of trying to make it. One of the things I do is I say I'm not going to tell you what to think. but I'm really going to encourage you to think.
Exactly.
And to me, that is the best, biggest thing I can do for them, is to make them into thinking beings. I say to them, the most amazing possession you're ever going to have is that 2 pounds of grey goo between your ears. Use it carefully, feed it well, and it will pay dividends.
Free your head, your ass will follow.
Yeah. I don't know, I just look at the world and I shake my head so many times.
I know.
Every day.
I know.
And I know you do.
my head's on a swivel at this point.
I was going to say, it's going to fall off one of these days.
Yeah, I'm just like...
Yours is going to fall off first on mine, but anyway.
Yeah, I guess I'm a sociological, physiological, psychological bobblehead at this point. Just,
Yep, I'm there too.
Dave, good talking to you. I'm so glad you called in.
Good to be back. As I say, just life's just been nuts for a little while, and getting on here was just not an option. Anyway, good talking to you. Keep doing what you do, and I'll get off on a rant another time.
Hang in there and be well.
You too.
Bye now.
Good talking.
Bye. Dave calling from Canada. And I guess we're fairly close to the end of the program this evening, but I'm not going to let the program end without making mention of this story, because it is so accursedly infuriating. Piracy on the high seas. The Israeli Navy has seized and kidnapped Cynthia McKinney and the boat that she was on that was carrying aid supplies to Gaza. And we're okay with it. The Israeli Navy has also kidnapped Merritt McGuire. She was an individual who laid everything on the line for peace in Northern Ireland. She is a Nobel laureate from 1977. Cynthia McKinney has said President Obama just told Israel to let in humanitarian and reconstruction supplies, and that's exactly what we tried to do. We're asking the international community to demand our release so we can resume our journey. The Israeli Defense Force has said any organization or country that wishes to transfer humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip can legally do so via the established crossings between Israel and the Gaza Strip with prior coordination. How many billions do we pour into that country? Now, you can call it what you will, but kidnapping is kidnapping, and this is a kidnapping. They are being held. They have not been released. Someday, some president is going to figure out that he has the right to say, listen, we're cutting off all the aid, every penny. Until you learn to behave like a responsible citizen of the world. The group is Free Gaza. The vessel is the Spirit of Humanity. They have gotten five aid missions into Gaza, but the Israeli military has stopped attempts in January and December of 2008, as well as this one. The Israeli Navy has confirmed this event, largely as reported. Cynthia McKinney has described it as, quote, an outrageous violation of international law. She has stated that they were not in Israeli waters, but were in international waters when they were hijacked. And the question is why Israel feels the need to maintain a stranglehold on something as simple as food and medicine for a cluster of suffering humanity. I don't know about you, but I don't approve of American dollars supporting that kind of conduct. And that is all I will say, because the incident speaks for itself. Free Cynthia McKinney. And that is the show for tonight. We've got some holdover stuff that we'll try to get to tomorrow. Hope you'll be here for prayer meeting. We should have fun. Thanks to John Fox, Peter Godbold, and Ben Birch, who are the technical brains of this outfit and make sure that everything works and keeps going. Thanks to the chat room moderators, the news ninjas, bloggers, everyone who helps create the public face of the horn on the internet. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Lodge. As you know by now, it is no joke when I say that they are the hardest working, bravest people I know. Would you have the self-restraint to stand stock still when some enraged, lumbering Massey wife reached out to punch you in the head? That's what the world is like in the Coal River Valley. And that is what makes Coal River Mountain Lodge so incredibly special. Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you tomorrow night. Free Cynthia McKinney. And always, Gina, it's all for you.
Cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome, welcome to this Tuesday evening edition of Head On. I am Bob Kincaid. Glad to be here. Glad you could be here. And just generally glad. I'm a glad kind of guy. I think it's going to be an interesting evening. It always is, as long as you're participating. And I don't know whether to go funny or go serious. I mean, okay, I don't know whether to go attempt at funny or attempt at serious. So we will start with the obvious good news. Good for some, not so good for others. It's a sad day for Norm Coleman. Norm Coleman is finally, really, an ex-member of the United States Senate. The man who was catapulted to the United States Senate over the corpse of Paul Wellstone has finally had to exit that august body. He will be replaced by a man at least somewhat closer to the spirit of Wellstone, though no one can replace Paul Wellstone, in the form of Al Franken. Al Franken will make the 60th Democrat in the United States Senate. And I said some people were happier than others. Obviously, Norm Coleman is crushed. Al Franken is happy. But I suspect there's someone else out there that I don't know how happy he is. I'm speaking, of course, of Harry Reid. Harry, I don't know if he's happy or not. I'm sure he's made some happy noises. But I don't know if he's happy or not, because at least for appearance's sake, Harry is now officially fresh out of excuses. Sixty members of the United States Senate are now at least nominally Democrats. So Harry is going to have to find new excuses for why we can't have employee free choice. Harry's going to have to find an excuse for why we're not actively being being represented in the Senate in terms of a public option in health care. Harry's going to have to come up with some new excuses. It's summer now, you know. We have passed the summer solstice. The sun is waxing stronger, hotter. Those long days of summer that I remember as a child, when you never had to come in because it seemed like it was never getting dark. They're here. And on a frozen day in January in Washington, D.C., in the Russell Senate office building, Harry Reid said, at my questioning, we will have a card check bill. That's what he called it. We will have a card check bill by summer. It's summer, Harry, and we don't have a card check bill. It's summer, Harry, and American workers still do not enjoy the full freedom of association guaranteed to them in the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. It's summer, Harry! And your promise is on the line. Your word is on the line. Your reputation is on the line, Harry. Where, Harry, is the Employee Free Choice Act? Is it being kept hidden from public view because you can't control your own caucus? Is it being kept off the floor of the United States Senate because mugwumps like Ben Nelson of Nebraska think more of major corporations than he does of working people in America, and yet he still calls himself a Democrat? Is that the problem? Is Blanche Lincoln the problem, Harry? She is, of course, the personal senator to the Walmart Corporation. Is David Pryor the problem? He's also from Arkansas. Is Mary Landrieu the problem? Soon we will be saying Senator Franken. What are you going to do with that 60 Democrat majority? Supposedly, you're filibuster-proof now, Harry. How are we supposed to feel out here, we who knocked on doors and shook hands and talked in line at the grocery store and the post office and the gas station? To get you that majority, Harry, how are we supposed to feel when we don't see you doing what we made it possible for you to do? How are we supposed to feel, Harry? Clock's run out, Harry. You're out of excuses, Harry. You know, when I was thinking about Senator Franken, for some reason the phrase came to mind, this is where the rubber chicken hits the road. Meets the road. Harry Reid, a man out of excuses and a man who, if he does not do something fairly soon, and by soon I mean yesterday, Harry Reid will be the biggest failure as a majority leader that the Democratic Party has ever, ever.